Kurt's shoulder, and then stood up himself. He shook out the legs of his pants, a fussy little gesture that was all Ted. "She was hurt, you see. Bobby found her. Bastard!" Liz screamed. To her right was a table with a vase on it. She grabbed the vase and threw it at him. Ted ducked, but too slowly to avoid it completely. The bottom of the vase struck the top of his head, skipped like a stone on a pond, hit the wall, and shattered. Carol screamed. "Mom, no!" Bobby shouted. "He didn't do anything bad. He didn't do anything bad." Liz took no notice. "How dare you touch her? Have you been touching my son the same way? You have, haven't you? You don't care what flavor they are, just as long as they're young?" Ted took a step toward her. The empty loops of his suspenders swung back and forth beside his legs. Bobby could see blooms of blood in the scant hair on top of his head where the vase had clipped him. "Mrs. Garfield, I assure you—" "Assure this, you dirty bastard!" With the vase gone, there was nothing left on the table, and so she picked up the table itself and threw it. It struck Ted in the chest and drove him backward. Would have floored him if not for the straight-backed chair. Ted flopped into it, looking at her with wide, incredulous eyes. His mouth was trembling. "Was he helping you?" Liz asked. Her face was dead white. The bruises on it stood out like birthmarks. "Did you teach my son to help?" "Mom, he didn't hurt her," Bobby shouted. He grabbed her around the waist. "He didn't hurt her. She picked him up like the vase, like the table." And he would think later she had been as strong as he had been, carrying Carol up the hill from the park. She threw him across the room. Bobby struck the wall. His head snapped back and connected with the sunburst clock, knocking it to the floor and stopping it forever. Black dots flocked across his vision, making him think briefly and confusedly, "Coming closer, and now the posters have his name on them, of the low men." Then he slid to the floor. He tried to stop himself, but his knees wouldn't lock. Liz looked at him, seemingly without much interest, then back at Ted, who sat in the straight-backed chair with the table in his lap and the legs poking at his face. Blood was dripping down one of his cheeks now, and his hair was more red than white. He tried to speak, and what came out instead was a dry and flailing old man's cigarette cough. "Filthy man, filthy, filthy man, for 2 cents I'd pull your pants down and yank that filthy thing right off you." She turned and looked at her huddled son again, and the expression Bobby now saw in the one eye he could really see, the contempt, the accusation, made him cry harder. She didn't say, "You too," but he saw it in her eye. Then she turned back to Ted. "Know what? You're going to jail!" She pointed a finger at him, and even through his tears Bobby saw the nail that had been on it when she left, and Mr. Biderman's murk was gone. There was a bloody ragged wheel where it had been. Her voice was mushy, seeming to spread out somehow as it crossed her oversized lower lip. "I'm going to call the police now. If you're wise, you'll sit still while I do it. Just keep your mouth shut and sit still." Her voice was rising, rising. Her hands scratched and swelled at the knuckles as well as broken at the nails, curled into fists, which she shook at him. "If you run, I'll chase you, and I'll carve you up with my longest butcher knife. See if I don't. I'll do it right on the street for everyone to see, and I'll start with the part of you that seems to give you boys, so much trouble. So sit still, Bradigan. If you want to live long enough to go to jail, don't you move." The phone was on the table by the couch. She went to it. Ted sat with the table in his lap and blood flowing down his cheek. Bobby huddled next to the fallen clock, the one his mother had gotten with trading stamps. Drifting in the window on the breeze of Ted's fan came Bowser's cry, "Roo! Roo! Roo!" "You don't know what happened here, Mrs. Garfield. What happened to you was terrible, and you have all my sympathy. But what happened to you is not what happened to Carol."
"Shut up!"
She wasn't listening, didn't even look in his direction. Carol ran to Liz, reached out for her, then stopped. Her eyes grew large in her pale face, her mouth dropped open. "They pulled your dress off?" It was half a whisper, half a moan. Liz stopped dialing and turned slowly to look at her.
"Why did they pull your dress off?"
Liz seemed to think about how to answer. She seemed to think hard. "Shut up," she said at last. "Just shut up. Okay?"
"Why did they chase you? Who's hitting?"
Carol's voice had become uneven. Who's
hitting?
Shut up! Liz dropped the telephone and put her hands to her ears. Bobby looked at her with growing horror. Carol turned to him. Fresh tears were rolling down her cheeks. There was knowing in her eyes. Knowing. The kind Bobby thought that he had felt while Mr. McQuown had been trying to fool him.
They chased her, Carol said. When she tried to leave, they chased her and made her come back.
Bobby knew. They had chased her down a hotel corridor. He had seen it. He couldn't remember where, but he had.
Make them stop doing it. Make me stop seeing it, Carol screamed. She's hitting them, but she can't get away. She's hitting them, but she can't get away.
Ted tipped the table out of his lap and struggled to his feet. His eyes were blazing. Hug her, Carol. Hug her tight. That will make it stop. Carol threw her good arm around Bobby's mother. Liz staggered backward a step, almost falling when one of her shoes hooked the leg of the sofa. She stayed up, but the telephone tumbled to the rug beside one of Bobby's outstretched sneakers, burring harshly. For a moment, things stayed that way. It was as if they were playing statues, and it had just yelled, freeze. It was Carol who moved first, releasing Liz Garfield's waist and stepping back. Her sweaty hair hung in her eyes. Ted went toward her and reached out to put a hand on her shoulder. Don't touch her, Liz said, but she spoke mechanically, without force. Whatever had flashed inside her at the sight of the child on Ted Brodigan's lap had faded a little, at least temporarily. She looked exhausted. Nonetheless, Ted dropped his hand. You're right, he said. Liz took a deep breath, held it, let it out. She looked at Bobby, then away. Bobby wished with all his heart that she would put her hand out to him, help him a little, help him get up, just that. But she turned to Carol instead. Bobby got to his feet on his own. What happened here? Liz asked Carol. Although she was still crying and her words kept hitching as she struggled for breath, Carol told Bobby's mom about how the three big boys had found her in the park, and how at first it had seemed like just another one of their jokes, a bit meaner than most, but still just a joke. Then Harry had really started hitting her, while the others held her. The popping sound in her shoulders scared them, and they ran away. She told Liz how Bobby had found her 5 or 10 minutes later. She didn't know how long because the pain had been so bad and carried her up here. And how Ted had fixed her arm after giving her Bobby's belt to catch the pain with. She bent, picked up the belt, and showed Liz the tiny tooth marks in it with a mixture of pride and embarrassment. I didn't catch all of it, but I caught a lot. Liz only glanced at the belt before turning to Ted. Why'd you tear her top off, Chief?
It's not torn, Bobby cried. He was suddenly furious with her. He cut it off so he could look at her shoulder and fix it without hurting her. I brought him the scissors, for cripe's sake. Why are you so stupid, Mom? Why can't you see?
She swung without turning, catching Bobby completely by surprise. The back of her open hand connected with the side of his face, her forefinger actually poked into his eye, sending a zag of pain deep into his head. His tears stopped as if the pump controlling them had suddenly shorted out.
Don't you call me stupid, Bobby-o, she said. Not on your ever-loving tintype.
Carol was looking fearfully at the hook-nosed witch who had come back in a taxi wearing Mrs. Garfield's clothes. Mrs. Garfield, who had run and who had fought when she couldn't run anymore. But in the end, they had taken what they wanted from her. You shouldn't hit Bobby, Carol said. He's not like those men.
Is he your boyfriend? She laughed. Yeah, good for you. But I'll let you in on a secret, sweetheart. He's just like his daddy, and your daddy, and all the rest of them. Go in the bathroom. I'll clean you up and find you something to wear. Christ, what a mess.
Carol looked at her a moment longer, then turned and went into the bathroom. Her bare back looked small and vulnerable and white so white in contrast to her brown arms. "Carol," Ted called after her, "is it better now?" Bobby didn't think he was talking about her arm. Not this time. "Yes," she said without turning, "but I can still hear her. Far away. She's screaming." "Who's screaming?" Liz asked. Carol didn't answer her. She went into the bathroom and closed the door. Liz looked at it for a moment, as if to make sure Carol wasn't going to pop back out again, then turned to Ted. "Who's screaming?" Ted only looked at her warily, as if expecting another ICBM attack at any moment. Liz began to smile. It was a smile Bobby knew, her "I'm losing my temper" smile. Was it possible she had any left to lose? With her black eyes, broken nose, and swollen lip, the smile made her look horrid. Not his mother, but some lunatic. "Quite the Good Samaritan, aren't you? How many feels did you cop while you were fixing her up? She hasn't got much, but I bet you checked what you could, didn't you? Never miss an opportunity, right? Come on and fess up to your mama." Bobby looked at her with growing despair. Carol had told her everything, all of the truth, and it made no difference. No difference. God. "There is a dangerous adult in this room," Ted said, "but it isn't me." She looked, first uncomprehending, then incredulous, then furious. "How dare you? How dare you?"
"He didn't do anything," Bobby screamed. "Didn't you hear what Carol said? Didn't you shut your mouth?" she said, not looking at him. She looked only at Ted. "The cops are going to be very interested in you, I think. Don called Hartford on Friday before I asked him to. He has friends there. You never worked for the state of Connecticut, not in the office of the comptroller, not anywhere else. You were in jail, weren't you?"
"In a way, I suppose I was," Ted said. He seemed calmer now, in spite of the blood flowing down the side of his face. He took the cigarettes out of his shirt pocket, looked at them, put them back. "But not the kind you're thinking of. And not in this world," Bobby thought.
"What was it for?" she asked. "Making little girls feel better in the first degree?"
"I have something valuable," Ted said. He reached up and tapped his temple. The finger he tapped with came away dotted with blood. "There are others like me, and there are people whose job it is to catch us, keep us, and use us for, well, use us. Leave it at that. I and two others escaped. One was caught. One was killed. Only I remain free, if that is," he looked around, "you call this freedom."
"You're crazy. Crazy old Bradigan, nuttier than a holiday fruitcake. I'm calling the police. Let them decide if they want to put you back in the jail you broke out of or in Danbury Asylum." She bent, reached over for the spilled phone. "No, Mom," Bobby said, and reached for a "don't."
"Bobby, no," Ted said sharply. Bobby pulled back, looking first at his mom as she scooped up the phone, then at Ted. "Not as she is now," Ted told him. "As she is now, she can't stop biting." Liz Garfield gave Ted a brilliant, almost unspeakable smile. "Good try, you bastard," and took the receiver off the cradle.
"What's happening?" cried Carol from the bathroom. "Can I come out now?"
"Not yet, darling," Ted called back. "A little longer."
Liz poked the telephone's cut-off buttons up and down. She stopped, listened, seemed satisfied. She began to dial. "We're going to find out who you are," she said. She spoke in a strange, confiding tone. "That should be pretty interesting, and what you've done. That might be even more interesting.
If you call the police, they'll also find out who you are and what you've done," Ted said.
She stopped dialing and looked at him. It was a cunning sideways stare Bobby had never seen before. "What in God's name are you talking about?"
"A foolish woman who should have chosen better. A foolish woman who had seen enough of her boss to know better. Who had overheard him and his cronies often enough to know better. To know that any seminar they attended mostly had to do with booze and sex parties. Maybe a little reefer as well. A foolish woman who let her greed overwhelm her good sense."
"What do you know
about being alone, she cried. I have a son to raise. She looked at Bobby as if remembering the son she had to raise for the first time in a little while.
How much of this do you want him to hear? Ted asked.
You don't know anything. You can't.
I know everything. The question is, how much do you want Bobby to know? How much do you want the neighbors to know? If the police come and take me, they'll know what I know. That I promise you.
He paused. His pupils remained steady, but his eyes seemed to grow.
I know everything. Believe me, don't put it to the test.
Why would you hurt me that way?
Given a choice, I wouldn't. You have been hurt enough. By yourself as well as by others. Let me leave. That's all I'm asking you to do. I was leaving anyway. Let me leave. I did nothing but try to help.
Oh, yes, she said and laughed. Help. Her sitting on you practically naked. Help.
I would help you if I...
Oh, yeah, and I know how.
She laughed again.
Bobby started to speak and saw Ted's eyes warning him not to. Behind the bathroom door, water was now running into the sink. Liz lowered her head, thinking. At last, she raised it again. All right, she said. Here's what I'm going to do. I'll help Bobby's little girl friend get cleaned up. I'll give her an aspirin and find something for her to wear home. While I'm doing those things, I'll ask her a few questions. If the answers are the right answers, you can go. Good riddance to bad rubbish. Mom! Liz held up a hand like a traffic cop, silencing him. She was staring at Ted, who was looking back at her. I'll walk her home. I'll watch her go through her front door. What she decides to tell her mother is between the two of them. My job is to see her home, safe, that's all. When it's done, I'll walk down to the park and sit in the shade for a little while. I had a rough night last night. She drew in breath and let it out in a dry and rueful sigh. Very rough. So I'll go to the park and sit in the shade and think about what comes next, how I'm going to keep him and me out of the poorhouse. If I find you still here when I get back from the park, sweetheart, I will call the police, and don't you put that to the test. Say whatever you want. None of it's going to matter much to anyone if I say I walked into my apartment a few hours sooner than you expected and found you with your hand inside an 11-year-old girl's shorts. Bobby stared at his mother in silent shock. She didn't see the stare. She was still looking at Ted, her swollen eyes fixed on him intently. If, on the other hand, I came back and you're gone, bag and baggage, I won't have to call anyone or say anything. Tout fini. I'll go with you, Bobby thought at Ted. I don't care about the low men. I'd rather have 1,000 low men in yellow coats looking for me, 1,000,000, than have to live with her anymore. I hate her. Well, Liz asked. It's a deal. I'll be gone in an hour, probably less. No, Bobby cried. When he'd awakened this morning, he had been resigned to Ted's going, sad but resigned. Now it hurt all over again, worse than before even. No! Be quiet, his mother said, still not looking at him.
It's the only way, Bobby, you know that.
Ted looked up at Liz. Take care of Carol, I'll talk to Bobby. You're in no position to give orders, Liz said. But she went. As she crossed to the bathroom, Bobby saw she was limping. A heel had broken off one of her shoes, but he didn't think that was the only reason she couldn't walk right. She knocked briefly on the bathroom door and then, without waiting for a response, slipped inside. Bobby ran across the room, but when he tried to put his arms around Ted, the old man took his hands, squeezed them once briefly, and then put them against Bobby's chest and let go. Take me with you, Bobby said fiercely. I'll help you look for them. 2 sets of eyes are better than 1. Take me with you.
I can't do that, but you can come with me as far as the kitchen, Bobby. Carol isn't the only one who needs to do some cleaning up.
Ted rose from the chair and swayed on his feet for a moment. Bobby reached out to steady him, and Ted once more pushed his hand gently but firmly away. It hurt. Not as much as his mother's failure to help him up, or even look at him, after she had thrown him against the wall. but enough. He walked with Ted to the kitchen, not touching him, but close enough to grab him if he fell. Ted didn't fall. He looked at the hazy reflections of himself in the window over the sink, sighed, then turned on the water. He wet the dishcloth and began to wipe the blood off his cheek, checking his window reflection every now and then for reference.
"Your mother needs you more now than she ever has before," he said. "She needs someone she can trust."
"She doesn't trust me. I don't think she even likes me." Ted's mouth tightened, and Bobby understood he had struck upon some truth Ted had seen in his mother's mind. Bobby knew she didn't like him. He knew that. So why were the tears threatening again? Ted reached out for him, seemed to remember that this was a bad idea, and went back to work with the dishcloth instead. "All right," he said. "Perhaps she doesn't like you. If that's true, it isn't because of anything you did. It's because of what you are. A boy," he said bitterly, "a fucking boy. And your father's son, don't forget that. But Bobby, whether she likes you or not, she loves you."
"Such a greeting card that sounds, I know, but it's true. She loves you and she needs you. You're what she has. She's badly hurt right now."
"Getting hurt was her own fault," he burst out. "She knew something was wrong. You said so yourself. She's known for weeks, months. But she wouldn't leave that job. She knew, and she still went with him to Providence. She went with him anyway."
"A lion tamer knows, but he still goes into the cage. He goes in because that's where his paycheck is."
"She's got money,"
Bobby almost spat. "Not enough, apparently."
"She'll never have enough,"
Bobby said, and knew it was the truth as soon as it was out of his mouth. "She loves you."
"I don't care. I don't love her."
"But you do. You will. You must. It is Ka."
"Ka? What's that?"
"Destiny."
Ted had gotten most of the blood out of his hair. He turned off the water and made one final check of his ghost image in the window. Beyond it lay all of that hot summer. Younger than Ted Brodigan would ever be again. Younger than Bobby would ever be again, for that matter.
Ka is destiny.
"Do you care for me, Bobby?"
"You know I do," Bobby said, beginning to cry again.
Lately, crying was all he seemed to do. His eyes ached from it. Lots and lots.
"Then try to be your mother's friend. For my sake, if not your own. Stay with her and help this hurt of hers to heal. And every now and then I'll send you a postcard."
They were walking back into the living room again. Bobby was starting to feel a little bit better, but he wished Ted could have put his arm around him. He wished that more than anything. The bathroom door opened. Carol came out first, looking down at her own feet with uncharacteristic shyness. Her hair had been wetted, combed back, and rubber-banded into a ponytail. She was wearing one of Bobby's mother's old blouses. It was so big it came almost down to her knees like a dress. You couldn't see her red shorts at all. "Go out on the porch and wait," Liz said. "Okay. You won't go walking home without me, will you?" "No," Carol said, and her downcast face filled with alarm. "Good. Stand right by my suitcases." Carol started out to the foyer, then turned back. "Thanks for fixing my arm, Ted. I hope you don't get in trouble for it. I didn't want..." "Go out on the damn porch," Liz snapped.
"Anyone to get in trouble," Carol finished in a tiny voice, almost the whisper of a mouse in a cartoon.
Then she went out, Liz's blouse flapping around her in a way that would have been comical on another day. Liz turned to Bobby, and when he got a good look at her, his heart sank. Her fury had been refreshed. A bright red flush had spread over her bruised face and down her neck. "Oh, cripes, what now?" Bobby thought. Then she held up the green key fob, and he knew.
"Where'd you get this, Bobby-o?"
"It..." But he could think of nothing to say. No fib, no outright lie, not even the truth. Suddenly Bobby felt very tired. The only thing in the world he wanted to do was creep into his bedroom and hide under the covers of his bed and go to sleep. "I gave it to him," Ted said mildly, "yesterday. You took my son to a bookie joint in Bridgeport, a poker parlor in Bridgeport?" "It doesn't say bookie joint on the key fob," Bobby thought. "It doesn't say poker parlor either, because those things are against the law. She knows what goes on there, because my father went there. And like father, like son. That's what they say. Like father, like son."
"I took him to a movie," Ted said. "Village of the Damned at the Criterion. While he was watching, I went to the corner pocket to do an errand."
"What sort of errand?"
"I placed a bet on a prize fight."
For a moment, Bobby's heart sank even lower, and he thought, "What's wrong with you? Why didn't you lie if you knew how she felt about stuff like that?" But he did know.
Of course he did.
"A bet on a prize fight?"
She nodded.
"Uh-huh. You left my son alone in a Bridgeport movie theater so you could go make a bet on a prize fight." She laughed wildly. "Oh, well, I suppose I should be grateful, shouldn't I? You brought him such a nice souvenir. If he decides to ever make a bet himself or lose his money playing poker like his father did, he'll know where to go."
"I left him for 2 hours in a movie theater," Ted said. "You left him with me. He seems to have survived both, hasn't he?"
Liz looked for a moment as if she had been slapped, then for a moment as if she would cry. Then her face smoothed out and became expressionless. She curled her fist around the green key fob and slipped it into her dress pocket. Bobby knew he would never see it again. He didn't mind. He didn't want to see it again.
"Bobby, go in your room," she said. "No! Bobby, go in your room! No, I won't!"
Standing in a bar of sunlight on the welcome mat by Liz Garfield's suitcases, floating in Liz Garfield's old blouse, Carol began to cry at the sound of the raised voices.
"Go in your room, Bobby," Ted said quietly. "I have enjoyed meeting you and knowing you."
"Knowing you," Bobby's mom said in an angry, insinuating voice, but Bobby didn't understand her, and Ted took no notice of her.
"Go in your room," he repeated.
"Will you be all right? You know what I mean?"
"Yes." Ted smiled, kissed his fingers, and blew the kiss toward Bobby. Bobby caught it and made a fist around it, holding it tight. "I'm going to be just fine."
Bobby walked slowly toward his bedroom door, his head down and his eyes on the toes of his sneakers. He was almost there when he thought, "I can't do this. I can't let him go like this." He ran to Ted, threw his arms around him, and covered his face with kisses. Forehead, cheeks, chin, lips, the thin and silky lids of his eyes. "Ted, I love you." Ted gave up and hugged him tight. Bobby could smell a ghost of the lather he shaved with and the stronger aroma of his Chesterfield cigarettes. They were smells he would carry with him a long time, as he would the memories of Ted's big hands touching him, stroking his back, cupping the curve of his skull.
"Bobby, I love you too," he said.
"Oh, for Christ's sake!" Liz nearly screamed. Bobby turned toward her, and what he saw was Don Biderman pushing her into a corner. Somewhere the Benny Goodman Orchestra was playing 1 o'clock jump on a hi-fi turned all the way up. Mr. Biderman had his hand out as if to slap. Mr. Biderman was asking her if she wanted a little more. Was that the way she liked it? She could have a little more if that was the way she liked it. Bobby could almost taste her horrified understanding. "You really didn't know, did you?" he said. "At least not all of it. All they wanted. They thought you did, but you didn't. Go in your room right now, or I'm calling the police and telling them to send a squad car," his mother said. "I'm not joking, Bobby O."
"I know you're not," Bobby said.
He went into his bedroom and closed the door. He thought at first he was all right. And then he thought that he was going to throw up or faint or do both. He walked across to his bed on tottery, unstable legs. He only meant to sit on it, but he lay back on it crosswise instead, as if all the muscles had gone out of his stomach and back. He tried to lift his feet up, but his legs only lay there, the muscles gone from them too. He had a sudden image of Sully John in his bathing suit climbing the ladder of a swimming float, running to the end of the board, diving off. He wished he was with SJ now. Anywhere but here. Anywhere but here. Anywhere at all but here. When Bobby woke up, the light in his room had grown dim, and when he looked at the floor, he could barely see the shadow of the tree outside his window. He had been out, asleep or unconscious, for 3 hours, maybe four. He was covered with sweat, and his legs were numb. He had never pulled them up onto the bed. Now he tried, and the burst of pins and needles which resulted almost made him scream. He slid onto the floor instead, and the pins and needles ran up his thighs to his crotch. He sat with his knees up around his ears, his back throbbing, his legs buzzing, his head cottony. Something terrible had happened, but at first he couldn't remember what. As he sat there, propped against the bed, looking across at Clayton Moore and his Lone Ranger mask, it began to come back. Carol's arm dislocated, his mother beaten up and half crazy as well, shaking that green key fob in his face, furious with him. And Ted. Ted would be gone by now. And that was probably for the best, but how it hurt to think of. He got to his feet and walked twice around the room. The second time he stopped at the window and looked out, rubbing his hands together at the back of his neck, which was stiff and sweaty. A little way down the street, the Sigsby twins, Dinah and Diane, were jumping rope, but the other kids had gone in either for supper or for the night. A car slid by, showing its parking lights. It was even later than he had at first thought. Heavenly shades of night were falling. He made another circuit of his room, working the tingles out of his legs, feeling like a prisoner pacing his cell. The door had no lock on it, no more than his mom's did, but he felt like a jailbird just the same. He was afraid to go out. She hadn't called him for supper. And although he was hungry, a little anyway, he was afraid to go out. He was afraid of how he might find her, or of not finding her at all. Suppose she had decided she'd finally had enough of Bobby-O, stupid, lying little Bobby-O, his father's son. Even if she was here and seemingly back to normal, was there even such a thing as normal? People had terrible things behind their faces sometimes. He knew that now. When he reached the closed door of his room, he stopped. There was a scrap of paper lying there. He bent and picked it up. There was still plenty of light, and he could read it easily. "Dear Bobby, by the time you read this, I'll be gone. But I'll take you with me in my thoughts. Please love your mother, and remember that she loves you. She was afraid and hurt and ashamed this afternoon, and when we see people that way, we see them at their worst. I have left you something in my room. I will remember my promise. All my love, Ted." The postcards, that's what he promised, to send me postcards. Feeling better, Bobby folded up the note Ted had slipped into his room before leaving and opened his bedroom door. The living room was empty. But it had been set to rights. It looked almost okay if you didn't know there was supposed to be a sunburst clock on the wall beside the TV. Now there was just a little screw where it had hung, jutting out and holding nothing. Bobby realized he could hear his mother snoring in her room.
She always snored, but this was a heavy snore, like an old person or a drunk snoring in a movie. That's because they hurt her, Bobby thought. And for a moment he thought of, how you doing, sport? How's a boy, Mr. Biderman, and the two Nimrods elbowing each other in the back seat and grinning. Kill the pig, cut her throat, Bobby thought. He didn't want to think it, but he did. He tiptoed across the living room as quietly as Jack in the Giant's castle opened the door to the foyer and went out. He tiptoed up the first flight of stairs, walking on the banister side, because he'd read in one of the Hardy Boys mysteries that if you walked that way, the stairs didn't creak so much, and ran up the second. Ted's door stood open. The room beyond it was almost empty. The few things of his own he'd put up, a picture of a man fishing at sunset, a picture of Mary Magdalene washing Jesus' feet, a calendar, were gone. The ashtray on the table was empty, but sitting beside it was one of Ted's carry-handle bags. Inside it were four paperback books. Animal Farm, The Night of the Hunter, Treasure Island, and Of Mice and Men. Written on the side of the paper bag in Ted's shaky but completely legible handwriting was, "Read the Steinbeck first. Guys like us," George says when he tells Lenny the story Lenny always wants to hear. "Who are guys like us? Who were they to Steinbeck? Who are they to you? Ask yourself this." Bobby took the paperbacks but left the bag. He was afraid that if his mom saw one of Ted's carry-handle bags, she would go crazy all over again. He looked in the refrigerator and saw nothing but a bottle of French's mustard and a box of baking soda. He closed the fridge again and looked around. It was as if no one had ever lived here at all, except he went to the ashtray, held it to his nose, and breathed in deeply. The smell of Chesterfields was strong, and it brought Ted back completely. Ted sitting here at his table and talking about Lord of the Flies, Ted standing at his bathroom mirror, shaving with that scary razor of his, listening through the open door as Bobby read him opinion pieces Bobby himself didn't understand. Ted leaving one final question on the side of a paper bag. Guys like us. Who are guys like us? Bobby breathed in again, sucking up little flakes of ash and fighting back the urge to sneeze, holding the smell in, fixing it in his memory as best he could, closing his eyes, and in through the window came the endless, ineluctable cry of Bowser, now calling down the dark like a dream. Roof, 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 roof. He put the ashtray down again. The urge to sneeze had passed. I'm going to smoke Chesterfields, he decided. I'm going to smoke them all my life. He went back downstairs, holding the paperbacks in front of him, and walking on the outside of the staircase again as he went from the second floor to the foyer. He slipped into the apartment, tiptoed across the living room, his mother was still snoring louder than ever, and into his bedroom. He put the books under his bed, deep under. If his mom found them, he would say Mr. Burton had given them to him. That was a lie, but if he told the truth, she'd take the books away. Besides, lying no longer seemed so bad. Lying might become a necessity. In time, it might even become a pleasure. What next? The rumble in his stomach decided him. A couple of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches were next. He started for the kitchen, tiptoeing past his mother's partly open bedroom door without even thinking about it, then paused. She was shifting around on her bed. Her snores had become ragged and she was talking in her sleep. It was a low, moaning talk Bobby couldn't make out, but he realized he didn't have to make it out. He could hear her anyway. And he could see stuff. Her thoughts. Her dreams. Whatever it was awful. He managed three more steps toward the kitchen, then caught a glimpse of something so terrible. His breath froze in his throat like ice. "Have you seen Brodigan? He is an old mongrel, but we love him."
"No," he whispered. "Oh, Mom. No."
He didn't want to go in there where she was, but his feet turned in that direction anyway. He went with them like a hostage. He watched his hand reach out, the fingers spread and push her bedroom door open all the way. Her bed was still made. She lay on top of the coverlet in her dress, one leg drawn up so her knee almost touched her chest. He could see the top of her stocking and her garter, and that made him think of the lady in the calendar picture at the corner pocket, the one getting out of the car with most of her skirt in her lap, except the lady getting out of the Packard hadn't had ugly bruises above the top of her stocking. Liz's face was flushed where it wasn't bruised. Her hair was matted with sweat. Her cheeks were smeary with tears and gooey with makeup. A board creaked under Bobby's foot as he stepped into the room. She cried out, and he froze, sure her eyes would open. Instead of awakening, she rolled away from him toward the wall. Here, in her room, the jumble of thoughts and images coming out of her was no clearer, but ranker and more pungent, like sweat pouring off a sick person. Running through everything was the sound of Benny Goodman playing 1 o'clock jump and the taste of blood running down the back of her throat. "Have you seen Brodigan?" Bobby thought. "He is an old mongrel, but we love him. Have you seen..." She had pulled her shades before lying down, and the room was very dark. He took another step, then stopped again by the table with the mirror where she sometimes sat to do her makeup. Her purse was there. Bobby thought of Ted hugging him. The hug Bobby had wanted, needed so badly. Ted stroking his back, cupping the curve of his skull. "When I touch, I pass on a kind of window," Ted had told him while they were coming back from Bridgeport in the cab. And now, standing by his mother's makeup table with his fists clenched, Bobby looked tentatively through that window into his mother's mind. He caught a glimpse of her coming home on the train, huddling by herself, looking into 10,000 backyards between Providence and Harwich, so as few people as possible would see her face. He saw her spying the bright green key fob on the shelf by the tooth glass as Carol slipped into her old blouse. Saw her walking Carol home, asking her questions the whole way, one after another, firing them like bullets out of a machine gun. Carol, too shaken and worn out to dissemble, had answered them all. Bobby saw his mother walking, limping, down to Commonwealth Park, heard her thinking, "If only some good could be salvaged from this nightmare, if only some good, anything good." He saw her sit on a bench in the shade and then get up after a while, walking towards Spicer's for a headache powder and a knee-high to wash it down with before going back home. And then just before leaving the park, Bobby saw her spy something tacked to a tree. These somethings were tacked up all over town. She might have passed a couple on her way to the park, so lost in thought she never noticed. Once again, Bobby felt like a passenger in his own body. No more than that. He watched his hand reach out, saw two fingers, the ones that would bear the yellow smudges of the heavy smoker in another few years, make a scissoring motion and catch what was protruding from the mouth of her purse. Bobby pulled the paper free, unfolded it, and read the first two lines in the faint light from the bedroom doorway. "Have you seen Brodigan? He is an old mongrel, but we love him." His eyes skipped halfway down to the lines that had no doubt riveted his mother and driven every other thought from her head. "We will pay a very large reward." Here was the something good she had been wishing for, hoping for, praying for. Here was a very large reward. And had she hesitated, had the thought, "Wait a minute, my kid loves that old bastard ball," even crossed her mind? Nah,
You couldn't hesitate because life was full of Don Bidermans, and life wasn't fair. Bobby left the room on tiptoe with the poster still in his hand, mincing away from her in big, soft steps, freezing when a board creaked under his feet, then moving on. Behind him, his mom's muttering talk had subsided into low snores again. Bobby made it into the living room and closed her door behind him, holding the knob at full cock until the door was shut tight, not wanting the latch to click. Then he hurried across to the phone, aware only now that he was away from her, that his heart was racing and his throat was lined with a taste like old pennies. Any vestige of hunger had vanished. He picked up the telephone's handset, looked around quickly and narrowly to make sure his mom's door was still shut, then dialed without referring to the poster. The number was burned into his mind. Housatonic 58337. There was only silence when he finished dialing. That wasn't surprising either, because there was no Housatonic exchange in Harwich. And if he felt cold all over, except for his balls and the soles of his feet, which were strangely hot, that was just because he was afraid for Ted. That was all. Just there was a stone-like click as Bobby was about to put the handset down, and then a voice said, "Yeah." "It's Spider-Man," Bobby thought wildly. "Crap, it's Spider-Man." "Yeah," the voice said again. "No. Not Bidermans. Too low for Bidermans." But it was a Nimrod voice, no doubt about that, and as his skin temperature continued to plummet toward absolute zero, Bobby knew that the man on the other end of the line had some sort of yellow coat in his wardrobe. Suddenly his eyes grew hot and the backs of them began itching. "Is this the Sagamore family?" was what he'd meant to ask, and if whoever answered the phone said yes, he'd meant to beg them to leave Ted alone, to tell them he, Bobby Garfield, would do something for them if they'd just leave Ted be. He'd do anything they asked, but now that his chance had arrived, he could say nothing. Until this moment, he still hadn't completely believed in the low men. No, something was on the other end of the line. Something that had nothing in common with life, as Bobby Garfield understood it. "Bobby?" the voice said, and there was a kind of insinuate pleasure in the voice, a sensuous recognition. "Bobby?" it said again, this time without the question mark. The flecks began to stream across Bobby's vision, the living room of the apartment suddenly filled with black snow. "Please," Bobby whispered. He gathered all of his will and forced himself to finish. "Please let him go."
"No can do," the voice from the void told him. "He belongs to the king. Stay away, Bobby. Don't interfere. Ted's our dog. If you don't want to be our dog, too, stay away." Click.
Bobby held the telephone to his ear a moment longer, needing to tremble and too cold to do it. The itching behind his eyes began to fade, though, and the threads falling across his vision began to merge into the general murk. At last he took the phone away from the side of his head, started to put it down, then paused. There were dozens of little red circles on the handset's perforated earpiece. It was as if the voice of the thing on the other end had caused the telephone to bleed. Panting, in soft and rapid little whimpers, Bobby put it back in its cradle and went into his room. "Don't interfere," the man at the Sagamore family number had told him. "Ted's our dog." But Ted wasn't a dog. He was a man, and he was Bobby's friend. "She could have told them where he'll be tonight," Bobby thought. "I think Carol knew. If she did, and if she told Mom..."
Bobby grabbed the bike fund jar. He took all the money out of it and left the apartment. He considered leaving his mother a note, but didn't. She might call Housatonic 58337 again if he did and tell the Nimrod with a low voice what her Bobbio was doing. That was one reason for not leaving a note. The other was that if he could warn Ted in time, he'd go with him. Now Ted would have to let him come, and if the low men killed him or kidnapped him, well, those things were almost the same as running away, weren't they? Bobby took a final look around the apartment, and as he listened to his mother's snore, he felt an involuntary tugging at his heart and mind. Ted was right. In spite of everything, he loved her still. If there was Ka, then loving her was part of his. Still, he hoped to never see her again. "Bye, Mom," Bobby whispered. A minute later, he was running down Broad Street Hill into the deepening gloom, one hand wrapped around the wad of money in his pocket so none of it would bounce out. Ten. Down there again. Corner boys. Low men in yellow coats. The payout. He called a cab from the pay telephone at Spicer's, and while he waited for his ride, he took down a Brodigan Lost Pet poster from the outside bulletin board. He also removed an upside-down file card advertising a 57 Rambler for sale by the owner. He crumpled them up and threw them in the trash barrel by the door, not even bothering to look back over his shoulder to see if old man Spicer, whose foul temper was legendary among the kids on the west side of Harwich, had seen him do it. The Sigsby twins were down here now. Their jump ropes put aside so they could play hopscotch. Bobby walked over to them and observed the shapes, a star, a comet, a crescent moon, drawn beside the grid. He got down on his knees, and Dinah Sigsby, who'd been about to toss her stone at the seven, stopped to watch him. Diane put her grimy fingers over her mouth and giggled. Ignoring them, Bobby used both of his hands to sweep the shapes into chalk blurs. When he was done, he stood up and dusted his hands off. The pole light in Spicer's tiny three-car parking lot came on. Bobby and the girls grew sudden shadows much longer than they were. "Why'd you do that, stupid old Bobby Garfield?" Dinah asked. "They were pretty." "They're bad luck," Bobby said. "Why aren't you at home?" Not that he didn't have a good idea. It was flashing in their heads like the beer signs in Spicer's window. "Mom and Daddy having a fight," Diane said. "She says he got a girlfriend." She laughed, and her sister joined in, but their eyes were frightened. They reminded Bobby of the Litlands in Lord of the Flies. "Go home before it gets all the way dark," he said. "Mama said stay out," Dinah told him. "Then she's stupid, and so is your father. Go on." They exchanged a glance, and Bobby understood that he had scared them even more. He didn't care. He watched them grab their jump ropes and go running up the hill. 5 minutes later, the cab he'd called pulled into the parking area beside the store, its headlights fanning the gravel.
"Huh," the cabbie said. "I don't know about taking any little kid to Bridgeport after dark, even if you do got the fare."
"It's okay," Bobby said, getting him back. If the cabbie meant to throw him out now, he'd better have a crowbar in the trunk to do it with. "My grandfather will meet me." But not at the corner pocket. Bobby'd already decided he wasn't going to pull up to the place in a checker. Someone might be watching for him.
"At the Woe Fat Noodle Company. That's on Narragansett Avenue."
The corner pocket was also on Narragansett. He hadn't remembered the street name, but had found it easily enough in the yellow pages after calling the cab. The driver had started to back out into the street. Now he paused again.
"Nasty Gansett Street? Christ, that's no part of town for a kid, not even in broad daylight."
"My grandfather's meeting me," Bobby repeated. "He said to tip you half a rock, you know, 50 cents. For a moment, the cabbie teetered. Bobby tried to think of some other way to persuade him and couldn't think of a thing. Then the cabbie sighed, dropped his flag, and got rolling. As they passed his building, Bobby looked to see if there were any lights on in their apartment. There weren't, not yet. He sat back and waited for Harwich to drop behind them. The cabbie's name was Roy Delois. It was on his taxi meter. He didn't say a word on the ride to Bridgeport. He was sad because he'd had to take Pete to the vet and have him put down. Pete had been 14. That was old for a collie. He had been Roy Deloyce's only real friend. "Go on, big boy, eat that up. It's on me," Roy Deloyce would say when he fed Pete. He said the same thing every night. Roy Deloyce was divorced. Sometimes he went to a stripper club in Hartford. Bobby could see ghost images of the dancers, most of whom wore feathers and long white gloves. The image of Pete was sharper. Roy Deloyce had been okay coming back from the vets, but when he saw Pete's empty dish in the pantry at home, he had broken down crying. They passed the William Penn Grill. Bright light streamed from every window, and the street was lined with cars on both sides for three blocks, but Bobby saw no crazy DeSotos or other cars that felt like thinly disguised living creatures. The backs of his eyes didn't itch. There were no black threads. The cab crossed the canal bridge, and then they were down there. Loud, Spanish-sounding music played from apartment houses with fire escapes zigzagging up the sides like iron lightning. Clusters of young men with gleaming comb-back hair stood on some street corners. Clusters of laughing girls stood on others. When the checker stopped at a red light, a brown-skinned man sauntered over, hips seeming to roll like oil in gabardine slacks that hung below the waistband of his bright white underwear shorts, and offered to wash the cabbie's windshield with a filthy rag he held. Roy Deloyce shook his head curtly and squirted away. The instant the light changed. "Goddamn specs," he said. "They should be barred from the country. Ain't we got enough niggers of our own?" Narragansett Street looked different at night. Slightly scarier, slightly more fabulous as well. Locksmiths, check-cashing services, a couple of bars spilling out laughter and jukebox music, and guys with beer bottles in their hands, rods, guns. And yes, just beyond rods and next to the shop selling special souvenirs, the Whoa Fat Noodle Company. From here it couldn't be more than four blocks to the corner pocket. It was only 8 o'clock. Bobby was in plenty of time. When Roy Deloyce pulled up to the curb, there was 80 cents on his meter. Add in a 50-cent tip, and you were talking about a big hole in the old bike fund, but Bobby didn't care. He was never going to make a big deal out of money the way she did. If he could warn Ted before the low men could grab him, Bobby would be content to walk forever. "I don't like leaving you off here," Roy Deloyce said. "Where's your grandpa?" "Oh, he'll be right along," Bobby said, striving for a cheerful tone and almost making it. It was really amazing what you could do when your back was against the wall. He held out the money. For a moment, Roy Deloyce hesitated instead of taking the dough, thought about driving him back to Spicer's, but if the kid's not telling the truth about his grandpa, what's he doing down here, Roy Deloyce thought. He's too young to want to get laid. "I'm fine," Bobby sent back. And yes, he thought he could do that too, a little anyway. "Go on, stop worrying, I'm fine." Roy Deloyce finally took the crumpled dollar and the trio of dimes. "This is really too much," he said. "My grandpa told me to never be stingy like some people are," Bobby said, getting out of the cab. "Maybe you ought to get a new dog, you know, a puppy." Roy Deloyce was maybe 50, but surprise made him look much younger.
"How?"
Then Bobby heard him decide he didn't care how. Roy Deloyce put his cab in gear and drove away, leaving Bobby in front of the Whoa Fat Noodle Company. He stood there until the cab's taillight disappeared, then began walking slowly in the direction of the corner pocket, pausing long enough to look through the dusty window of special souvenirs. The bamboo blind was up, but the only special souvenir on display was a ceramic ashtray in the shape of a toilet. There was a groove for a cigarette in the seat. "Park your butt" was written on the tank. Bobby considered this quite witty. But not much of a window display. He had sort of been hoping for items of a sexual nature, especially now that the sun had gone down. He walked on, past B-Port Printing, and Shoes Repaired While You Wait, and Snappy Cards for All Occasions. Up ahead was another bar, more young men on the corner, and the sound of the Cadillacs. Brrr, black slacks make you cool, daddy-o. When you put 'em on, you're a rarin' to go. Bobby crossed the street, trotting with his shoulders hunched, his head down and his hands in his pockets. Across from the bar was an out-of-business restaurant with a tattered awning still overhanging its soaped windows. Bobby slipped into its shadow and kept going, shrinking back once when someone shouted and a bottle shattered. When he reached the next corner, he recrossed Nasty Gansett Street on the diagonal, getting back to the side the corner pocket was on. As he went, he tried to tune his mind outward and pick up some sense of Ted, but there was nothing. Bobby wasn't all that surprised. If he had been Ted, he would have gone someplace like the Bridgeport Public Library, where he could hang around without being noticed. Maybe after the library closed, he'd get a bite to eat, kill a little more time that way. Eventually, he'd call another cab and come to collect his money. Bobby didn't think he was anywhere close yet, but he kept listening for him. He was listening so hard that he walked into a guy without even seeing him. "Hey, cabron," the guy said, laughing, but not in a nice way. Hands grabbed Bobby's shoulders and held him. "Where was you think you gone, Putino?" Bobby looked up and saw four young guys, what his mom would have called corner boys, standing in front of a place called Bodega. They were Puerto Ricans, he thought, and all wearing sharp creased slacks, black boots with pointed toes poked out from beneath their pants cuffs. They were also wearing blue silk jackets with the word Diablos written on the back. The eye was a devil's pitchfork. Something seemed familiar about the pitchfork, but Bobby had no time to think about that. He realized with a sinking heart that he had wandered into four members of some gang. "I'm sorry," he said in a dry voice. "Really, excuse me." He pulled back from the hands holding his shoulders and started around the guy. He made just a single step before one of the others grabbed him. "Where you going, Tio?" this one asked. "Where you going, Tio mio?" Bobby pulled free, but the fourth guy pushed him back at the second. The second guy grabbed him again, not so gently this time. It was like being surrounded by Harry and his friends, only worse.
"You got any money, Tio?" asked the third guy. "'Cause this is a toll road, you know."
They all laughed and moved in closer. Bobby could smell their spicy aftershaves, their hair tonics, his own fear. He couldn't hear their mind voices, but did he need to? They were probably going to beat him up and steal his money. If he was lucky, that was all they'd do, but he might not be lucky.
"Little boy,"
the fourth guy almost sang. He reached out a hand, gripped the bristles of Bobby's crew cut, and pulled hard enough to make tears well up in Bobby's eyes.
"Little muchacho, what you got for money, huh? How much of the good old dinero? You have something, and we're going to let you go. You have nothing, and we're going to bust your balls. Leave him alone, Juan."
They looked around, Bobby too, and here came a fifth guy, also wearing a Diablos jacket, also wearing slacks with a sharp crease. He had on loafers instead of pointy-toed boots, and Bobby recognized him at once. It was the young man who had been playing the Frontier Patrol game in the corner pocket when Ted was making his bet. No wonder that pitchfork shape had looked familiar. It was tattooed on the guy's hand. His jacket had been tied inside out around his waist. "No club jacket in here," he'd told Bobby, but he wore the sign of the Diablos just the same. Bobby tried to look into the newcomer's mind and saw only dim shapes. His ability was fading again, as it had on the day Mrs. Gerber took them to Savin Rock. Shortly after they left McQuown's stand at the end of the midway, it had been gone. This time, the winkle had lasted longer, but it was going now, all right.
"Hey, Dee," said the boy who had pulled Bobby's hair. "We're just going to shake this little guy out a little, make him pay his way across Diablo turf." "Not this one," Dee said. "I know him. He's my compadre. He looked like a pansy uptown boy to me," said the one who had called Bobby Cabron and Putino. "I teach him a little respect." "He don't need no lesson from you," Dee said. "You want one from me, Mozo?"
Mozo stepped back, frowning, and took a cigarette out of his pocket. One of the others snapped him a light, and Dee drew Bobby a little further down the street.
"What are you doing down here, amigo?"
he asked, gripping Bobby's shoulder with the tattooed hand. "You stupid to be down here alone, and you fucking loco to be down here at night alone." "I can't help it," Bobby said. "I have to find the guy I was with yesterday. His name is Ted. He's old and thin and pretty tall. He walks kind of hunched over like Boris Karloff, you know, the guy in the scary movies."
"I know Boris Karloff, but I don't know no fucking Ted," Dee said. "I don't ever see him, man. You got to get out of here."
I have to go to the corner pocket, Bobby said. I was just there, Dee said. I didn't see no guy like Boris Karloff. It's still too early. I think you'll be there between 9:30 and 10. I have to be there when he comes because there's some men after him. They wear yellow coats and white shoes. They drive big, flashy cars. One of them's a purple DeSoto. And Dee grabbed him and spun him against the door of a pawn shop so hard that for a moment, Bobby thought he decided to go along with his corner boy friends after all. Inside the pawn shop, an old man with a pair of glasses pushed up on his bald head looked around, annoyed, then back down at the newspaper he was reading.
The jefes in the long yellow coats, Dee breathed. I seen those guys. Some of the others seen them, too. You don't want to mess with boys like that, Chico. Something wrong with those boys. They don't look right. Make the bad boys hang around Mallory's saloon look like good boys.
Something in Dee's expression reminded Bobby of Sully John, and he remembered S.J. saying he'd seen a couple of weird guys outside Commonwealth Park. When Bobby asked what was weird about them, Sully said he didn't exactly know. Bobby knew, though. Sully had seen the low men. Even then, they had been sniffing around.
When did you see them, Bobby asked. Today?
Can't give me a break, he said. I ain't been up but 2 hours. And most of that I've been in the bathroom making myself pretty for the street. I seen them coming out of the corner pocket, a pair of them, day before yesterday, I think.
And that place, funny lately.
He thought for a moment, then called, "Yo, Juan, get your ass over here."
The crew cut puller came trotting over. Dee spoke to him in Spanish. Juan spoke back, and Dee responded more briefly, pointing to Bobby. Juan leaned over Bobby, hands on the knees of his sharp pants.
"You seen these guys, huh?"
Bobby nodded.
"One bunch in a big purple DeSoto, one bunch in a Chrysler, one bunch in a Olds 98.
Bobby only knew the DeSoto, but he nodded.
"Those cars ain't real cars,"
Juan said. He looked sideways at Dee to see if Dee was laughing. Dee wasn't. He only nodded for Juan to keep going.
"They ain't something else."
"I think they're alive," Bobby said.
Juan's eyes lit up. "Yeah, like alive. And those men.
What do they look like? I've seen one of their cars, but not them." Dee translated some of it, but in an absent fashion, more and more he was conversing with Juan and ignoring Bobby and the other corner boys, and boys were what they really were, Bobby saw, drew close and added their own contributions. Bobby couldn't understand their talk, but he thought they were scared, all of them. They were tough enough guys. Down here you had to be tough just to make it through the day, but the low men had frightened them all the same. Bobby caught one final clear image, a tall, striding figure in a calf-length mustard-colored coat, the kind of coat men sometimes wore in movies like Gunfight at the OK Corral and The Magnificent Seven.
"I see 4 of them coming out of that barbershop with the horse parlor in the back,"
the one who seemed to be named Filio said.
"That's what they do, those guys. Go into places and ask questions. Always leave one of their big cars running at the curb. You'd think it'd be crazy to do that down here, leave a car running at the curb, but who'd steal one of those goddamn things?"
No one, Bobby knew. If you tried, the steering wheel might turn into a snake and strangle you. The seat might turn into a quicksand pool and drown you.
"They come out all in a bunch,"
Filio went on.
"All wearing those long yellow coats, even though the day's so hot you could fry the egg on the fucking sidewalk. They was all wearing those nice white shoes, sharp. You know, I always notice what people got on their feet. I get hard for that shit. And I don't think.
He paused, gathering himself, and said something to Dee in Spanish. Bobby asked what he'd said.
"He's saying their shoes wasn't touching the ground,"
Juan replied. His eyes were big. There was no scorn or disbelief in them.
"He's saying they got this big red Chrysler, and when they go back to it, their fucking shoes ain't quite touching the ground."
Juan forked 2 fingers in front of his mouth, spat through them, then crossed himself. No one said anything for a moment or 2 after that, and then Dee bent gravely over Bobby again.
"These are the guys looking for your friend."
"That's right," Bobby said. "I have to warn him."
He had a mad idea that Dee would offer to go with him to the corner pocket, and then the rest of the Diablos would join in. They would walk up the street, snapping their fingers in unison like the Jets in West Side Story. They would be his friends now, gang guys who happened to have really good hearts. Of course, nothing of the sort happened. What happened was Moso wandered off back toward the place where Bobby had walked into him. The others followed. Juan paused long enough to say, "You run into those caballeros and you gonna be one dead putino, tio mio." Only Dee was left, and Dee said, "He's right. You all go back to your own part of the world, my friend. Let your amigo take care of himself." "I can't," Bobby said. And then, with genuine curiosity, "Could you?"
"Not against ordinary guys, maybe, but these ain't ordinary guys. Was you just listen?"
"Yes," Bobby said. "But you crazy little boy, poco loco." I guess so. He felt crazy, all right. Poco loco and then some. Crazy as a shithouse mouse, his mother would have said. Dee started away, and Bobby felt his heart cramp. The big boy got to the corner. His buddies were waiting for him on the other side of the street, then wheeled back, made his finger into a gun, and pointed it at Bobby. Bobby grinned and pointed his own back.
"Vaya con Dios, mi amigo loco,"
Dee said, then sauntered across the street with the collar of his gang jacket turned up against the back of his neck. Bobby turned the other way and started walking again, detouring around the pools of light cast by fizzing neon signs and trying to keep in the shadows as much as he could. Across the street from the corner pocket was a mortuary, the Spengyi funeral parlor, it said on the green awning. Hanging in the window was a clock whose face was outlined in a chilly circle of blue neon. Below the clock was a sign which read, "Time and tide wait for no man." According to the clock, it was 8:20. He was still in time, in plenty of time, and he could see an alley beyond the pocket where he might wait in relative safety. But Bobby couldn't just park himself and wait, even though he knew that would be the smart thing to do. If he'd really been smart, he never would have come down here in the first place. He wasn't a wise old owl. He was a scared kid who needed help. He doubted if there was any in the corner pocket, but maybe he was wrong. Bobby walked under the banner reading, "Come in, it's cool inside." He had never felt less in need of air conditioning in his life. It was a hot night, but he was cold all over. "God, if you're there, please help me now. Help me to be brave, and help me to be lucky." Bobby opened the door and went in. The smell of beer was much stronger and much fresher, and the room with the pinball machines in it banged and jangled with lights and noise. Where before only Dee had been playing pinball, there now seemed to be at least 24 guys, all of them smoking, all of them wearing strap-style undershirts and Frank Sinatra Hello Young Lovers hats, all of them with bottles of Bud parked on the glass tops of the Gottlieb machines. The area by Len Files' desk was brighter than before because there were more lights on in the bar where every stool was taken, as well as in the pinball room. The pool hall itself, which had been mostly dark on Wednesday, was now lit like an operating theater. There were men at every table, bending and circling and making shots in a blue fog of cigarette smoke. The chairs along the walls were all taken. Bobby could see old G with his feet up on the shoeshine posts and,
"What the fuck are you doing here?"
Bobby turned, startled by the voice and shocked by the sound of that word coming out of a woman's mouth. It was Alana Files. The door to the living room area behind the desk was just swinging shut behind her. Tonight, she was wearing a white silk blouse that showed her shoulders, pretty shoulders, creamy white and as round as breasts, and the top of her prodigious bosom. Below the white blouse were the largest pair of red slacks Bobby had ever seen. Yesterday, Alana had been kind, smiling, almost laughing at him, in fact, although in a way Bobby hadn't minded. Tonight she looked scared to death.
"I'm sorry. I know I'm not supposed to be in here, but I need to find my friend Ted, and I thought that—"
He heard his voice shrinking like a balloon that's been let loose to fly around the room.
Something was horribly wrong. It was like a dream he sometimes had, where he was at his desk studying spelling or science or just reading a story, and everyone started laughing at him, and he realized he had forgotten to put his pants on before coming to school. He was sitting at his desk with everything hanging out for everyone to look at, girls and teachers and just everyone. The beat of the bells in the game room hadn't completely quit, but it had slowed down. The flood of conversation and laughter from the bar had dried up almost entirely. The click of pool and billiard balls had ceased. Bobby looked around, feeling those snakes in his stomach again. They weren't all looking at him, but most were. Old G was staring with eyes that looked like holes burned in dirty paper, and although the window in Bobby's mind was almost opaque now, soaped over, he felt that a lot of the people in here had sort of been expecting him. He doubted if they knew it, and even if they did, they wouldn't know why. They were kind of asleep, like the people of Midwich. The low men had been in. The low men had...
Get out, Randy,
Alana said in a dry little whisper. In her distress, she had called Bobby by his father's name.
Get out while you still can.
Old G had slid out of the shoeshine chair. His wrinkled seersucker jacket caught on one of the foot pedestals and tore as he started forward, but he paid no attention as the silk lining floated down beside his knee like a toy parachute. His eyes looked more like burned holes than ever.
Get him, Old G said in a wavery voice. Get that kid.
Bobby had seen enough. There was no help here. He scrambled for the door and tore it open. Behind him, he had the sense of people starting to move, but slowly, too slowly, Bobby Garfield ran out into the night. He ran almost two full blocks before a stitch in his side forced him to first slow down and stop. No one was following, and that was good. But if Ted went into the corner pocket to collect his money, he was finished, done, kaput. It wasn't just the low man he had to worry about. Now there was old G and the rest of them to worry about, too, and Ted didn't know it. The question was, what could Bobby do about it? He looked around and saw the storefronts were gone. He'd come to an area of warehouses. They loomed like giant faces from which most of the features had been erased. There was a smell of fish and sawdust and some vague, rotted perfume that might have been old meat. There was nothing he could do about it. He was just a kid, and it was out of his hands. Bobby realized that, but he also realized he couldn't let Ted walk into the corner pocket without at least trying to warn him. There was nothing Hardy Boys heroic about this, either. He simply couldn't leave without making the effort. And it was his mother who had put him in this position. His own mother.
I hate you, Mom,
he whispered. He was still cold, but sweat was pouring out of his body. Every inch of his skin felt wet. I don't care what Don Biderman and those other guys did to you. You're a bitch, and I hate you. Bobby turned and began to trot back the way he had come, keeping to the shadows. Twice he heard people coming and crouched in doorways, making himself small until they had passed by. Making himself small was easy. He had never felt smaller in his life. This time he turned into the alley. There were garbage cans on one side and a stack of cartons on the other full of returnable bottles that smelled of beer. This cardboard column was half a foot taller than Bobby, and when he stepped behind it, he was perfectly concealed from the street. Once, during his wait, something hot and furry brushed against his ankle, and Bobby started to scream. He stifled most of it before it could get out, looked down and saw a scruffy alley cat looking back up at him with green headlamp eyes.
"Scat, Pat!"
Bobby whispered and kicked at it. The cat revealed the needles of its teeth, hissed, then did a slow strut back down the alley, weaving around the clots of refuse and strews of broken glass, its tail lifted in what looked like disdain. Through the brick wall beside him, Bobby could hear the dull throb of the corner pocket's juke. Mickey and Sylvia were singing "Love is Strange." It was strange, all right. A big, strange pain in the ass. From his place of concealment, Bobby could no longer see the mortuary clock, and he lost any sense of how much or how little time was passing.
Beyond the beer and garbage reek of the alley, a summer street life opera was going on. People shouted out to one another, sometimes laughing, sometimes angry, sometimes in English, sometimes in one of a dozen other languages. There was a rattle of explosions that made him stiffen. Gunshots was his first idea, and then he recognized the sound as firecrackers, probably lady fingers, and relaxed a little again. Cars blasted by, many of them brightly painted rail jobs and jack jobs with chrome pipes and glass-pack mufflers. Once there was what sounded like a fist fight with people gathered around yelling encouragement to the scufflers. Once a lady, who sounded both drunk and sad, went by singing Where the Boys Are in a beautiful, slurry voice. Once there were police sirens, which approached and then faded away again. Bobby didn't doze exactly, but fell into a kind of daydream. He and Ted were living on a farm somewhere, maybe in Florida. They worked long hours, but Ted could work pretty hard for an old guy, especially now that he'd quit smoking and had some of his wind back. Bobby went to school under another name, Ralph Sullivan, and at night they sat on the porch, eating Ted's cooking and drinking iced tea. Bobby read to him from the newspaper, and when they went into bed, they slept deeply, and their sleep was peaceful, interrupted by no bad dreams. When they went to the grocery store on Fridays, Bobby would check the bulletin board for lost pet posters or upside-down file cards advertising items for sale by owner, but he never found any. The low man had lost Ted's scent. Ted was no longer anyone's dog, and they were safe on their farm. Not father and son, or grandfather and grandson, but only friends. Guys like us. Bobby thought drowsily. He was leaning against the brick wall now, his head slipping downward until his chin was almost on his chest. Guys like us. Why shouldn't there be a place for guys like us? Lights splashed down the alley. Each time this had happened, Bobby had peered around the stack of cartons. This time he almost didn't. He wanted to close his eyes and think about the farm, but he forced himself to look, and what he saw was the stubby yellow tail fin of a checker cab just pulling up in front of the corner pocket. Adrenaline flooded Bobby and turned on lights in his head he hadn't even known about. He dodged around the stack of boxes, spilling the top two off. His foot struck an empty garbage can and knocked it against the wall. He almost stepped on a hissing furry something, the cat again. Bobby kicked it aside and ran out of the alley. As he turned toward the corner pocket, he slipped on some sort of greasy goo and went down on one knee. He saw the mortuary clock and its cool blue ring, 9:45. The cab was idling at the curb in front of the corner pocket's door. Ted Brodigan was standing beneath the banner reading, "Come in, it's cool inside," paying the driver. Bent down to the driver's open window like that, Ted looked more like Boris Karloff than ever. Across from the cab, parked in front of the mortuary, was a huge Oldsmobile as red as Alana's pants. It hadn't been there earlier, Bobby was sure of that. Its shape wasn't quite solid. Looking at it didn't just make your eyes want to water, it made your mind want to water. "Ted!" Bobby tried to yell, but no yell came out. All he could produce was a straw-like whisper. Why doesn't he feel them, Bobby thought. How come he doesn't know? Maybe because the low men could block him out somehow? Or maybe the people inside the corner pocket were doing the blocking. Old G and all the rest, the low men had perhaps turned them into human sponges that could soak up the warning signals Ted usually felt. More lights splashed the street. As Ted straightened and the checker pulled away, the purple DeSoto sprang around the corner. The cab had to swerve to avoid it. Beneath the streetlights, the DeSoto looked like a huge blood clot decorated with chrome and glass. Its headlights were moving and shimmering like lights seen underwater. And then they blinked. They weren't headlights at all. They were eyes. "Ted!" Still, nothing but that dry whisper came out, and Bobby couldn't seem to get back on his feet. He was no longer sure he even wanted to get back on his feet. A terrible fear. As disorienting as the flu and as debilitating as a cataclysmic case of the squitters was enveloping him. Passing the blood clot DeSoto outside the William Penn Grill had been bad. To be caught in its oncoming eye lights was 1,000 times worse. No, 1,000,000 times. He was aware that he had torn his pants and scraped blood out of his knee. He could hear Little Richard,
howling from someone's upstairs window, and he could still see the blue circle around the mortuary clock like a flashbulb afterimage tattooed on the retina, but none of that seemed real. Nasty Gansett Avenue suddenly seemed no more than a badly painted backdrop. Behind it was some unsuspected reality, and reality was dark. The DeSoto's grill was moving.
Snarling, those cars ain't real cars, Wanted said. They're something else.
They were something else, all right.
Ted!
A little louder this time. And Ted heard. He turned toward Bobby, eyes widening, and then the DeSoto bounced up over the curb behind him, its blazing, unsteady headlights pinning Ted and making his shadow grow as Bobby's and the Sigsbee girl's shadows had grown when the pole light came on in Spicer's little parking lot. Ted wheeled back toward the DeSoto, raising one hand to shield his eyes from the glare. More light swept the street. This time it was a Cadillac coming up from the warehouse district, a snot-green Cadillac that looked at least a mile long. A Cadillac with fins like grins and sides that moved like the lobes of a lung. It thumped up over the curb just behind Bobby, stopping less than a foot from his back. Bobby heard a low, panting sound. The Cadillac's motor, he realized, was breathing. Doors were opening in all three cars. Men were getting out, or things that looked like men at first glance. Bobby counted six, counted eight, stopped counting. Each of them wore a long, mustard-colored coat, the kind that was called a duster, and on the right front lapel of each was the staring crimson eye Bobby remembered from his dream. He supposed the red eyes were badges. The creatures wearing them were...
What? Cops? No, a posse like in a movie that was a little closer. Vigilantes? Closer still, but still not right. They were.
They're regulators. Like in that movie me and SJ saw at the Empire last year, the one with John Payne and Karen Steele. That was it. Oh, yes. The regulators in the movie had turned out to be just a bunch of bad guys. But at first you thought they were ghosts or monsters or something. Bobby thought that these regulators really were monsters. One of them grasped Bobby under the arm. Bobby cried out. The contact was quite the most horrible thing he had ever experienced in his life. It made being thrown against the wall by his mother seem like very small change indeed. The low man's touch was like being grasped by a hot water bottle that had grown fingers, only the feel of them kept shifting. It would feel like fingers in his arm, but then like claws. Fingers, claws, fingers. That unspeakable touch buzzed into his flesh, reaching both up and down. It's Jack's dick, he thought crazily, the one sharpened at both ends. Bobby was pulled toward Ted, who was surrounded by the others. He stumbled along on legs that were too weak to walk. Had he thought he would be able to warn Ted? That they would run away together down Narragansett Avenue, perhaps even skipping a little the way Carol used to? That was quite funny, wasn't it? Incredibly, Ted didn't seem afraid. He stood in the semicircle of low men, and the only emotion on his face was concern for Bobby. The thing gripping Bobby, now with a hand, now with loathsome pulsing rubber fingers, now with a clutch of talons, suddenly let him go. Bobby staggered, reeled. One of the others uttered a high, barking cry and pushed him in the middle of the back. Bobby flew forward and Ted caught him. Sobbing with terror, Bobby pressed his face against Ted's shirt. He could smell the comforting aromas of Ted's cigarettes and shaving soap, but they weren't strong enough to cover the stench that was coming from the low men. A meaty, garbagey smell, and a higher smell, like burning whiskey that was coming from their cars. Bobby looked up at Ted. It was my mother, he said. It was my mother who told.
This isn't her fault, no matter what you may think, Ted replied. I simply stayed too long.
But it was a nice vacation, Ted?
One of the low men asked. His voice had a gruesome buzz, as if his vocal cords were packed with bugs, locusts, or maybe crickets. He could have been the one Bobby spoke to on the phone, the one who said Ted was their dog. But maybe they all sounded the same. If you don't want to be our dog, too, stay away, the one on the phone had said. But he had come down here anyway, and now, oh, now. Wasn't bad, Ted replied.
I hope you at least got laid, another said, because you probably won't get another chance.
Bobby looked around. The low men stood shoulder to shoulder, surrounding them, pinning them in their smell of sweat and maggoty meat, blocking off any sight of the street with their yellow coats. They were dark-skinned, deep-eyed, red-lipped, as if they'd been eating cherries. But they weren't what they looked like. They weren't what they looked like at all. Their faces wouldn't stay in their faces, for one thing. Their cheeks and chins and hair kept trying to spread outside the lines. It was the only way Bobby could interpret what he was seeing. Beneath their dark skins were skins as white as their pointed reet petite shoes. But their lips are still red, Bobby thought. Their lips are always red. As their eyes were always black, not really eyes at all, but caves. And they are so tall, he realized, so tall and so thin. There are no thoughts like our thoughts in their brains, no feelings like our feelings in their hearts. From across the street there came a thick, slobbering grunt. Bobby looked in that direction and saw that one of the Oldsmobile's tires had turned into a blackish-gray tentacle. It reached out, snared a cigarette wrapper, and pulled it back. A moment later, the tentacle was a tire again, but the cigarette wrapper was sticking out of it like something half-swallowed.
"Ready to come back, horse?"
one of the low men asked Ted. He bent toward him, the folds of his yellow coat rustling stiffly, the red eye on the lapel staring.
"Ready to come back and do your duty?"
"I'll come," Ted replied, "but the boy stays here." More hands settled on Bobby, and something like a living branch caressed the nape of his neck. It set off that buzzing again, something that was both an alarm and a sickness. It rose into his head and hummed it like a hive. Within that lunatic hum he heard first one bell tolling rapidly, then many. A world of bells in some terrible black night of hot hurricane winds. He supposed he was sensing, wherever the low men had come from, an alien place trillions of miles from Connecticut and his mother. Villages were burning under unknown constellations. People were screaming, and that touch on his neck, that awful touch. Bobby moaned and buried his head against Ted's chest again.
"He wants to be with you," an unspeakable voice crooned. "I think we'll bring him, Ted. He has no natural ability as a breaker, but still all things serve the king, you know."
The unspeakable fingers caressed again. "All things serve the beam," Ted said in a dry, correcting voice, his teacher's voice.
"Not for much longer," the low man said and laughed.
The sound of it loosened Bobby's bowels.
"Bring him,"
said another voice. It held a note of command. They did all sound sort of alike, but this was the one he had spoken to on the phone, Bobby was sure.
"No,"
Ted said. His hands tightened on Bobby's back. "He stays here."
"Who are you to give us orders?" the low man in charge asked. "How proud you have grown during your little time of freedom, Ted. How haughty. Yet soon you'll be back in the same room where you have spent so many years with the others, and if I say the boy comes,
Then the boy comes.
If you bring him, you'll have to go on taking what you need from me, Ted said. His voice was very quiet, but very strong. Bobby hugged him as tight as he could and shut his eyes. He didn't want to look at the low men, not ever again. The worst thing about them was that their touch was like Ted's, in a way. It opened a window. But who would want to look through such a window? Who would want to see the tall, red-lipped scissor shapes as they really were? Who would want to see the owner of that red eye?
You're a breaker, Ted. You were made for it. Born to it. And if we tell you to break, you'll break, by God.
You can force me. I'm not so foolish as to think you can't. But if you leave him here, I'll give what I have to you freely. And I have more to give than you could... Well, perhaps you could imagine it.
I want the boy,
the low man in charge said, but now he sounded thoughtful, perhaps even doubtful.
I want him as a pretty, something to give the king.
I doubt if the Crimson King will thank you for a meaningless pretty if it interferes with his plans, Ted said. There is a gunslinger.
Gunslinger!
Ha! Yet, he and his friends have reached the borderland of Endworld, Ted said. And now, he was the one who sounded thoughtful. If I give you what you want instead of forcing you to take it, I may be able to speed things up by 50 years or more. As you say, I'm a breaker made for it and born to it. There aren't many of us. You need everyone, and most of all you need me, because I'm the best.
You flatter yourself and you overestimate your importance to the king.
Do I? I wonder. Until the beams break, the dark tower stands. Surely I don't need to remind you of that. Is one boy worth the risk? Bobby hadn't the slightest idea what Ted was talking about and didn't care. All he knew was that the course of his life was being decided on the sidewalk outside a Bridgeport billiard parlor. He could hear the rustle of the low men's coats. He could smell them. Now that Ted had touched him again, he could feel them even more clearly. That horrible itching behind his eyes had begun again, too. In a weird way, it harmonized with the buzzing in his head. The black specks drifted across his vision, and he was suddenly sure what they meant, what they were for. In Clifford Simak's book, Ring Around the Sun, it was a top that took you off into other worlds. You followed the rising spirals. In truth, Bobby suspected it was the specks that did it. The black specks, they were alive. And they were hungry.
Let the boy decide, the leader of the lowmen said at last. His living branch of a finger caressed the back of Bobby's neck again. He loves you so much, Teddy. You're his tika, aren't you? That means destiny's friend, Bobby. Oh, isn't that what this old smoky-smelling teddy bear is to you? Your destiny's friend?
Bobby said nothing, only pressed his cold, throbbing face against Ted's shirt. He now repented coming here with all his heart. Would have stayed home hiding under his bed if he had known the truth of the low men, but yes, he supposed Ted was his tika. He didn't know about stuff like destiny. He was only a kid, but Ted was his friend. Guys like us, Bobby thought miserably, guys like us.
So, how do you feel now that you see us? The low man asked. Would you like to come with us so you can be close to good old Ted? Perhaps see him on the odd weekend? Discuss literature with your dear old tika. Learn to eat what we eat and drink what we drink.
The awful fingers again caressing. The buzzing in Bobby's head increased. The black specks fattened And now they look like fingers, beckoning fingers.
Whee! Eat it hot, Bobby,
the low man whispered.
And drink it hot as well. Hot and sweet. Hot and sweet.
Stop it, Ted snapped.
Or would you rather stay with your mother?
The crooning voice went on, ignoring Ted.
Surely not. Not a boy of your principles. Not a boy who has discovered the joys of friendship and literature. Surely you'll come with this wheezy old Kamai, won't you? Or will you? Decide, Bobby. Do it now. And knowing that what you decide is what will bide. Now and forever.
Bobby had a delirious memory of the lobsterback cards blurring beneath McQuown's long white fingers. Now they go, now they slow, now they rest. Here's the test. I fail, Bobby thought. I fail the test. Let me go, mister, he said miserably. Please don't take me with you.
Even if it means your tea car has to go on without your wonderful and revivifying company?
The voice was smiling, but Bobby could almost taste the knowing contempt under its cheery surface, and he shivered with relief because he understood he was probably going to be let free after all. With shame, because he knew what he was doing, crawling, chintzing, chickening out. All the things the good guys in the movies and books he loved never did. But the good guys in the movies and books never had to face anything like the low men in the yellow coats or the horror of the black specks. And what Bobby saw of these things here outside the corner pocket was not the worst of it either. What if he saw the rest? What if the black specks drew him into the world where he saw the men in yellow coats as they really were? What if he saw the shapes inside the ones they wore in this world? Yes, he said, and began to cry.
Yes, what?
Even if he has to go without me?
And even if it means going back to your mother?
Yes.
You perhaps understand your bitch of a mother a little better now, do you?
Yes, Bobby said for the third time. By now he was nearly moaning. I guess I do. That's enough, Ted said. Stop it. But the voice wouldn't. Not yet.
You've learned how to be a coward, Bobby. Haven't you?
Yes, he cried, still with his face against Ted's shirt. A baby. A little chicken shit baby. Yes, 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 I don't care. Just let me go home. He drew in a great, long, unsteady breath and let it out in a scream. I want my mother! It was the howl of a terrified little one who has finally glimpsed the beast from the water, the beast from the air.
All right, the low man said, since you put it that way, assuming your teddy bear confirms that he'll go to work with a will and not have to be chained to his oar as previously,
I promise. Ted let go of Bobby. Bobby remained as he was, clutching Ted with panicky tightness and pushing his face against Ted's chest until Ted pushed him gently away. Go inside the pool hall, Bobby. Tell Files to give you a ride home. Tell him if he does that, my friends will leave him alone. I'm sorry, Ted. I wanted to come with you. I meant to come with you, but I can't. I'm so sorry.
You shouldn't be hard on yourself. But Ted's look was heavy, as if he knew that from tonight on, Bobby would be able to be nothing else. Two of the yellow coats grasped Ted's arms,
Ted looked at the one standing behind Bobby, the one who had been caressing the nape of Bobby's neck with that horrible stick-like finger. They don't need to do that, Cam. I'll walk.
Let him go, Cam said. The low man holding Ted released his arms.
Then for the last time, Cam's finger touched the back of Bobby's neck. Bobby uttered a choked wail. He thought, if he does it again, I'll go crazy. I won't be able to help it. I'll start to scream, and I won't be able to stop. Even if my head bursts open, I'll go on screaming.
Get inside there, little boy. Do it before I change my mind and take you anyway.
Bobby stumbled toward the corner pocket. The door stood open but empty. He climbed a single step, then turned back. Three of the low men were clustered around Ted, but Ted was walking toward the blood clot DeSoto on his own. Ted! Ted turned, smiled, started to wave. Then the one called Cam leaped forward, seized him, whirled him, and thrust him into the car. As Cam swung the DeSoto's back door shut, Bobby saw for just an instant an incredibly tall, incredibly scrawny being standing inside a long yellow coat, a thing with flesh as white as new snow and lips as red as fresh blood. Deep in its eye sockets were savage points of light and dancing flecks of darkness in pupils which swelled and contracted as Ted's had done. The red lips peeled back, revealing needly teeth that put the alley cats to shame. A black tongue lolled out from between those teeth and wagged an obscene goodbye. Then the creature in the yellow coat sprinted around the hood of the purple DeSoto, thin legs, gnashing thin knees, pumping and plunged in behind the wheel. Across the street, the old started up, its engine sounding like the roar of an awakening dragon. Perhaps it was a dragon. From its place, skewed halfway across the sidewalk, the Cadillac's engine did the same. Living headlights flooded this part of Narragansett Avenue in a pulsing glare. The DeSoto skidded in a U-turn, one fender skirt scraping up a brief train of sparks from the street, and for a moment, Bobby saw Ted's face in the DeSoto's back window. Bobby raised his hand and waved. He thought Ted raised his own in return, but could not be sure. Once more, his head filled with a sound like hoofbeats. He never saw Ted brought again.
Bug out, kid,
Len Files said. His face was cheesy white, seeming to hang off his skull the way the flesh hung off his sister's upper arms. Behind him, the lights of the Gottlieb machines in the little arcade flashed and flickered with no one to watch them. The cool cats, who made an evening specialty of corner pocket pinball, were clustered behind Len Files like children. To Len's right were the pool and billiard players, many of them clutching cues like clubs. Old G stood off to one side by the cigarette machine. He didn't have a pool cue. From one gnarled old hand there hung a small automatic pistol. It didn't scare Bobby. After Cam and his yellow coat friends, he didn't think anything would have the power to scare him right now. For the time being, he was all scared out. Put an egg in your shoe and beat it, kid, now. Better do it, kiddo. That was Alana, standing behind the desk. Bobby glanced at her and thought, if I was older, I bet I'd give you something. I bet I would. She saw his glance, the quality of his glance, and looked away, flushed and frightened and confused. Bobby looked back at her brother. You want those guys back here? Len's hanging face grew even longer. Are you kidding? Okay then, Bobby said. Give me what I want and I'll go away. You never see me again. He paused. Or them.
What you want, kid?
Old G asked in his wavering voice. Bobby was going to get whatever he asked for. It was flashing in old G's mind like a big bright sign. That mind was as clear now as it had been when it had belonged to young G, cold and calculating and unpleasant. But it seemed innocent. After Cam and his regulators. Innocent as ice cream. A ride home, Bobby said. That's number one. Then speaking to old G rather than Len, he gave them number two. Len's car was a Buick. Big, long, and new. Vulgar, but not low. Just a car. The two of them rode to the sound of dance band music from the 40s. Len spoke only once during the trip to Harwich. Don't you go tuning that to no rock and roll. I have to listen to enough of that shit at work. They drove past the Asher Empire, and Bobby saw it was a life-sized cardboard cutout of Brigitte Bardot standing to the left of the ticket booth. He glanced at it without very much interest. He felt too old for BB now. They turned off Asher. The Buick slipped down Broad Street Hill like a whisper behind a cupped hand. Bobby pointed out his building. Now the apartment was lit up all right. Every light was blazing. Bobby looked at the clock on the Buick's dashboard and saw it was almost 11 p.m. As the Buick pulled to the curb, Len Files found his tongue again. Who were they, kid? Who were those gonifs? Bobby almost grinned. It reminded him of how at the end of almost every Lone Ranger episode, someone said, who was that masked man? Low men, he told Len. Low men in yellow coats. I wouldn't want to be your pal right now. No, Bobby said. A shudder shook through him like a gust of wind. Me neither. Thanks for the ride. Don't mention it. Just stay the fuck clear of my felts and greens from now on. You're banned for life. The Buick, a boat, a Detroit cabin cruiser, but not low, drew away. Bobby watched as it turned into a driveway across the street and then headed back up the hill past Carol's building. When it had disappeared around the corner, Bobby looked up at the stars. Stacked billions. A spilled bridge of light. Stars and more stars beyond them, spinning in the black. There is a tower, he thought. It holds everything together. There are beams that protect it somehow. There is a crimson king. And breakers working to destroy the beams. Not because the breakers want to, but because it wants them to, the Crimson King. Was Ted back among the rest of the breakers yet? Bobby wondered, back and pulling his oar. I'm sorry, he thought, starting up the walk to the porch. He remembered sitting there with Ted reading to him from the newspaper, just a couple of guys. I wanted to go with you, but I couldn't. In the end, I couldn't. He stopped at the bottom of the porch steps, listening for Bowser around on Colony Street. There was nothing. Bowser had gone to sleep. It was a miracle. Smiling wanly, Bobby got moving again. His mother must have heard the creak of the second porch step. It was pretty loud because she cried out his name. And then there was the sound of her running footsteps. He was on the porch when the door flew open and she ran out, still dressed in the clothes that she had been wearing when she came home from Providence. Her hair hung around her face in wild curls and tangles. Bobby, she cried out, Bobby, oh, Bobby, thank God, thank God. She swept him up, turning him around and around in a kind of dance, her tears wetting one side of his face. I wouldn't take their money, she babbled. They called me back and asked for the address so that they could send a check, and I said, never mind, it was a mistake. I was hurt and upset. I said, no, Bobby. I said, no. I said I didn't want their money. Bobby saw she was lying. Someone had pushed an envelope with her name on it under the foyer door. Not a check. $300 in cash. $300 for the return of their best breaker. 300 lousy rocks. They were even bigger cheapskates than she was. I said I didn't want it. Did you hear me? Carrying him into the apartment now. He weighed almost 100 pounds and was too heavy for her, but she carried him anyway. As she babbled on, Bobby realized they wouldn't have the police to contend with, at least. She hadn't called them. Mostly, she had just been sitting here, plucking at her wrinkled skirt and praying incoherently that he would come home. She loved him. That beat in her mind like the wings of a bird trapped in a barn. She loved him. It didn't help much, but it helped a little. Even if it was a trap, it helped a little. I said I didn't want it. We didn't need it. They could keep their money. I told them, that's good, Mommy said. That's good. Put me down.
Where have you been? Are you all right? Are you hungry? He answered her questions back to front. I'm hungry, yeah, but I'm fine. I went to Bridgeport. I got this. He reached into his pants pocket and brought out the remains of the bike fund money. His ones and change were mixed into a messy green wad of tens and twenties and fifties. His mother stared at the money as it rained down on the end table by the sofa, her good eye growing bigger and bigger until Bobby was afraid it might tumble right out of her face. She looked like a battered old pirate gloating over freshly unburied treasure, an image Bobby could have done without, and one which never entirely left him during the 15 years between that night and the night of her death. Yet some new and not particularly pleasant part of him enjoyed that look, how it rendered her old and ugly and comic, a person who was stupid as well as avaricious. "That's my ma," he thought in a Jimmy Durante voice. "That's my ma. We both gave him up, but I got paid better than you did, ma, didn't I? Yeah. Hacha." "Bobby," she whispered in a trembly voice. She looked like a pirate and sounded like a winning contestant on that Bill Cullen show, The Price is Right. "Oh, Bobby, so much money. Where did it come from?" "Ted's bet," Bobby said. "This is the payout." "But Ted, won't he?" "He won't need it anymore." Liz winced as if one of her bruises had suddenly twinged. Then she began sweeping the money together, sorting the bills even as she did so. "I'm going to get you that bike," she said. Her fingers moved with the speed of an experienced three-card Monte dealer. No one beats that shuffle, Bobby thought. No one has ever beaten that shuffle. "First thing in the morning, soon as the Western Auto opens, then we'll go." "I don't want a bike," he said. "Not from that and not from you." She froze with her hands full of money, and he felt her rage bloom at once, something red and electrical. "No thanks from you, are there? I was a fool to ever expect any. God damn you if you're not the spitting image of your father." She drew back her hand again with the fingers open. The difference this time was that he knew it was coming. She had blindsided him for the last time. "How would you know?" Bobby asked. "You've told so many lies about him, you don't remember the truth." And this was so. He had looked into her, and there was almost no Randall Garfield there. Only a box with his name on it. His name, and a faded image that could have been almost anyone. This was the box where she kept the things that hurt her. She didn't remember about how he liked that Joe Stafford song, didn't remember, if she'd ever known, that Randy Garfield had been a real sweetie who'd give you the shirt right off his back. There was no room for things like that in the box she kept. Bobby thought it must be awful to need a box like that. "He wouldn't buy a drunk a drink," he said. "Did you know that?"
"What are you talking about?"
"You can't make me hate him, and you can't make me into him." He turned his right hand into a fist and cocked it by the side of his head. "I won't be his ghost. Tell yourself as many lies as you want to about the bills he didn't pay, and the insurance policy he lost out on, and all the inside straights he tried to fill, but don't tell them to me. Not anymore."
"Don't raise your hand to me, Bobby O. Don't you ever raise your hand to me."
In answer, he held up his other hand, also fisted. "Come on. You want to hit me? I'll hit you back. You can have some more, only this time you'll deserve it. Come on." She faltered. He could feel her rage dissipating as fast as it had come, and what replaced it was a terrible blackness. In it, he saw, was fear. Fear of her son. Fear that he might hurt her. Not tonight, no, not with those grimy little boy fists, but little boys grew up. And was he so much better than her that he could look down his nose and give her the old la-di-da? Was he any better? In his mind, he heard the unspeakable crooning voice asking if he wanted to go back home, even though it meant Ted would have to go on without him. "Yes," Bobby'd said. "Even if it meant going back to his bitch of a mother." "Yes," Bobby'd said. "You understand her a little bit better now, do you?" Cam had asked, and once again Bobby had said, "Yes." And when she recognized his step on the porch,
There had at first been nothing in her mind but love and relief. Those things had been real. Bobby unmade his fists. He reached up and took her hand, which was still held back to slap, although now without much conviction. It resisted at first, but Bobby at last soothed the tension from it. He kissed it. He looked at his mother's battered face and kissed her hand again. He knew her so well, and he didn't want to. He longed for the window in his mind to close, longed for the opacity that made love not just possible, but necessary. The less you knew, the more you could believe. "It's just a bike I don't want," he said. "Okay, just a bike." "What do you want?" she asked. Her voice was uncertain, dreary. "What do you want from me, Bobby?" "Pancakes," he said. "Lots." He tried to smile. "I am so hungry." She made enough pancakes for both of them, and they ate breakfast at midnight, sitting across from each other at the kitchen table. He insisted on helping her with the dishes, even though it was going on toward one by then. "Why not?" he asked her. There was no school the next day. He could sleep as late as he wanted. As she was letting the water out of the sink and Bobby was putting the last of their silverware away, Bowser began barking over on Colony Street, "Roof, roof, roof," into the dark of a new day. Bobby's eyes met his mother's. They laughed, and for a moment, knowing was all right. At first he lay in bed the old way, on his back with his heels spread to the lower corners of the mattress, but the old way no longer felt right. It felt exposed, as if anything that wanted to bag a boy could simply burst out of his closet and unzip his upturned belly with one claw. He rolled over on his side and wondered where Ted was now. He reached out, feeling for something that might be Ted. And there was nothing, just as there had been nothing earlier on nasty Gansett Street. Bobby wished he could cry for Ted, but he couldn't. Not yet. Outside, crossing the dark like a dream, came the sound of the clock in the town square, one single bong. Bobby looked at the luminous hands of the Big Ben on his desk and saw they were standing at 1 o'clock. That was good. "They're gone," Bobby said. "The low men are gone." But he slept on his side with his knees drawn up to his chest. His nights of sleeping wide open on his back were over. Wolves and lions, Bobby at bat, Officer Raymer, Bobby and Carol, bad times, an envelope. Sully John returned from camp with a tan,
10,000 healing mosquito bites and 1,000,000 tales to tell. Only Bobby didn't hear many of them. That was the summer the old, easy friendship among Bobby and Sully and Carol broke up. The three of them sometimes walked down to Sterling House together, but once they got there, they went to different activities. Carol and her girlfriends were signed up for crafts and softball and badminton, Bobby and Sully for junior safaris and baseball. Sully, whose skills were already maturing, moved up from the wolves to the lions. And while all the boys went on the swimming and hiking safaris together, sitting in the back of the battered old Sterling House panel truck with their bathing suits and their lunches and paper sacks, S.J. more and more often sat with Ronnie Olmquist and Duke Wendell, boys with whom he had been at camp. They told the same old stories about short-sheeting beds and sending the little kids on snipe hunts until Bobby was bored with them. You'd think Sully'd been at camp for 50 years. On the 4th of July, the Wolves and Lions played their annual head-to-head game. In a decade and a half, going back to the end of World War II, the Wolves had never won one of these matches. But in the 1960 contest, they at least made a game of it, mostly because of Bobby Garfield. He went 3 for 3, and even without his Alvin Dark glove, made a spectacular diving catch in center field, getting up and hearing the applause he wished only briefly for his mother, who hadn't come to the annual holiday outing at Lake Canton. Bobby's last hit came during the Wolves' final turn at bat. They were down by 2, with a runner at second. Bobby drove the ball deep to left field, and as he took off toward first, he heard S.J. grunt, "Good hit, Bob," from his catcher's position behind the plate. It was a good hit, but he was the potential tying run and should have stopped at second base. Instead, he tried to stretch it. Kids under the age of 13 were almost never able to get the ball back into the infield accurately, but this time, Sully's Camp Winnie friend Duke Wendell threw a bullet from left field to Sully's other Camp Winnie friend, Ronnie Olmquist. Bobby slid, but felt Ronnie's glove slap his ankle a split second before his sneaker touched the bag.
"You're out!"
cried the umpire, who had raced up from home plate to be on top of the play. On the sidelines, the friends and relatives of the Lions cheered hysterically. Bobby got up, glaring at the ump, a Sterling House counselor of about 20, with a whistle and a white smear of zinc oxide on his nose.
"I was safe!"
"Sorry, Bob," the kid said, dropping his ump impersonation and becoming a counselor again. "It was a good hit and a great slide, but you were out."
"Was not, you cheater! Why do you want to cheat?"
"Throw him out, someone's dad called. There's no call for guff like that." "Go sit down, Bobby," the counselor said.
"I was safe," Bobby shouted. "Safe by a mile."
He pointed at the man who had advised he be tossed from the game. "Did he pay you to make sure we lost, that fatso there?" "Quit it, Bobby," the counselor said. How stupid he looked, with his little beanie hat from some Nimrod college fraternity in his whistle. "I'm warning you." Ronnie Olmquist turned away as if disgusted by the argument. Bobby hated him, too. "You're nothing but a cheater," Bobby said. He could hold back the tears pricking the corners of his eyes, but not the waver in his voice. "That's the last I'll take," the counselor said. "Go sit down and cool off." "You cheating cocksucker, that's what you are." A woman close to third gasped and turned away. "That's it," the counselor said in a toneless voice. "Get off the field right now." Bobby walked halfway down the baseline between third and home, his sneakers scuffling, then turned back. "By the way, a bird shit on your nose. I guess you're too dumb to figure that out. Better go wipe it off." It sounded funny in his head, but stupid when it came out, and nobody laughed. Sully was straddling home plate, big as a house and serious as a heart attack in his ragtags of catching gear. His mask, mended all over with black tape, dangled from one hand. He looked flushed and angry. He also looked like a kid who would never be a wolf again. S.J. had been to Camp Winnie, had short-sheeted beds, stayed up late telling ghost stories around a campfire. He would be a lion forever, and Bobby hated him. "What's wrong with you?" Sully asked as Bobby plodded by. Both benches had fallen silent. All the kids were looking at him. All the parents were looking at him, too, looking at him as though he was something disgusting. Bobby guessed he probably was, just not for the reasons they thought. "Guess what, S.J.? Maybe you've been to Camp Winnie, but I've been down there, way down there. Bobby?" "Nothing's wrong with me," he said without looking up. "Who cares? I'm moving to Massachusetts. Maybe there's less Twinkie-Dink cheaters there." "Listen, man." "Oh, shut up." Bobby said without looking at him. He looked at his sneakers instead, just looked at his sneakers, and kept on walking. Liz Garfield didn't make friends. "I'm a plain brown moth, not a social butterfly," she sometimes told Bobby. But during her first couple of years at Hometown Real Estate, she had been on good terms with a woman named Myra Calhoun. In Liz's ease, she and Myra saw eye to eye, marched to the same drummer, were tuned to the same wavelength, etc., etc. In those days, Myra had been Don Biderman's secretary. And Liz had been the entire office pool, shuttling between agents making their appointments and their coffee, typing their correspondence. Myra had left the agency abruptly, without much explanation, in 1955. Liz had moved up to her job as Mr. Biderman's secretary in early 1956. Liz and Myra had remained in touch, exchanging holiday cards and the occasional letter. Myra, who was what Liz called a maiden lady, had moved to Massachusetts and opened her own little real estate firm. In late June of 1960, Liz wrote her and asked if she could become a partner, a junior one to start with, of course, in Calhoun Real Estate Solutions. She had some capital she could bring with her. It wasn't a lot, but neither was $3,500 a spit in the ocean. Maybe Miss Calhoun had been through the same ringer his mom had been through. Maybe not. What mattered was that she said yes. She even sent his mom a bouquet of flowers. And Liz was happy for the first time in weeks, perhaps truly happy for the first time in years. What mattered was they were moving from Harwich to Danvers, Massachusetts. They were going in August, so Liz would have plenty of time to get her Bobby O, her newly quiet and often glum Bobby O, enrolled in a new school. What also mattered was that Liz Garfield's Bobby O had a piece of business to take care of before leaving Harwich. He was too young and small to do what needed doing in a straightforward way. He would have to be careful, and he'd have to be sneaky. Sneaky was all right with Bobby. He no longer had much interest in acting like Audie Murphy or Randolph Scott in the Saturday matinee movies, and besides, some people needed ambushing, if only to find out what it felt like. The hiding place he picked was the little copse of trees where Carol had taken him on the day he went all ushy-gushy and started crying, a fitting spot in which to wait for Harry Doolin, old Mr. Robin Hood riding through the glen. Harry had gotten a part-time stock boy job at Total Grocery. Bobby had known that for weeks, had seen him there when he went shopping with his mom. Bobby had also seen Harry walking home after his shift ended at 3 o'clock. Harry was usually with one or more of his friends. Richie O'Meara was his most common sidekick. Willie Sherman seemed to have dropped out of old Robin Hood's life, just as Sully had pretty much dropped out of Bobby's. But whether alone or in company, Harry Doolin always cut across Commonwealth Park on his way home. Bobby started to drift down there in the afternoons. It was only morning baseball now that it was really hot, and by 3 o'clock fields A, B, and C were deserted. Sooner or later, Harry would walk back from work and past those deserted fields without Richie or any of his other merry men to keep him company. Meanwhile, Bobby spent the hour between 3 and 4 p.m. each day in the copse of trees where he had cried with his head in Carol's lap. Sometimes he read a book. The one about George and Lenny made him cry again. "Guys like us that work on ranches are the loneliest guys in the world," that was how George saw it. "Guys like us got nothing to look ahead to."
Lenny thought the two of them were going to get a farm and raise rabbits, but long before Bobby got to the end of the story, he knew there would be no farms and no rabbits for George and Lenny. Why? Because people needed a beast to hunt. They found a Ralph or a Piggy or a big stupid hulk of a Lenny, and then they turned into low men. They put on their yellow coats. They sharpened a stick at both ends, and then they went hunting. But guys like us sometimes get a little of our own back, Bobby thought, as he waited for the day when Harry would show up alone. Sometimes we do. August 6th turned out to be the day. Harry strolled through the park, toward the corner of Broad and Commonwealth, still wearing his red total grocery apron. What a fucking Nimrod. And singing Mac the Knife in a voice that could have melted screws. Careful not to rustle the branches of the close-growing trees, Bobby stepped out behind him and closed in, walking softly on the path and not cocking back his baseball bat until he was close enough to be sure. As he raised it, he thought of Ted saying, "Three boys against one little girl, they must have thought you were a lion." But, of course, Carol wasn't a lion. Neither was he. He was Sully, who was the lion, and Sully hadn't been there, wasn't here now. The one creeping up behind Harry Doolin wasn't even a wolf. He was just a hyena. But so what? Did Harry Doolin deserve any better? Nope, Bobby thought, and swung the bat. It connected with the same satisfying thud he'd felt at Lake Canton when he'd gotten his third and best hit, the one to deep left. Connecting with the small of Harry Doolin's back was even better. Harry screamed with pain and surprise and went sprawling. When he rolled over, Bobby brought the bat down on his leg at once, the blow this time landing just below the left knee. Ow! Harry screamed. It was most satisfying to hear Harry Doolin scream, close to bliss, in fact. Ow! That hurts! That hurts! Can't let him get up, Bobby thought, picking his next spot with a cold eye. He's twice as big as me. If I miss once and let him get up, he'll tear me limb from limb. He'll fucking kill me. Harry was trying to retreat, digging at the gravel path with his sneakers, dragging a groove with his butt, paddling with his elbows. Bobby swung the bat and hit him in the stomach. Harry lost his air and his elbows and sprawled on his back. His eyes were dazed, filled with sun-bright tears. His pimples stood out in big purple and red dots. His mouth, thin and mean on the day Rhonda Houston had rescued him, was now a big, loose quiver. Oh, stop! I give! Oh, Jesus! He doesn't recognize me, Bobby realized. The sun's in his eyes. He doesn't even know who it is. That wasn't good enough. Not satisfactory, boys, was what the Camp Winnie counselors said after a bad cabin inspection. Sully had told him that, not that Bobby cared. Who gave a shit about cabin inspections and making bee wallets? But he gave a shit about this, yes, indeed. And he leaned close to Harry's agonized face. "Remember me, Robin Hood?" he asked. "You remember me, don't you? I'm the Maltex baby." Harry stopped screaming. He stared up at Bobby, finally recognized him. "Get you..." He managed. "You won't get shit," Bobby said, and when Harry tried to grab his ankle, Bobby kicked him in the ribs. "Oh!" Harry Doolin cried, reverting to his former scripture. What a creep, Nimrod infants on parade. That probably hurt me more than it hurt you, Bobby thought. Kicking people when you're wearing sneakers is for dumbbells. Harry rolled over. As he scrambled for his feet, Bobby uncoiled a home run swing and drove the bat squarely across Harry's buttocks. The sound was like a carpet beater hitting a heavy rug, a wonderful sound. The only thing that could have improved this moment would have been Mr. Biterman also sprawled on the path. Bobby knew exactly where he'd like to hit him. Half a loaf was better than none, though, or so his mother always said. "That was for the Gerber baby," Bobby said. Harry was lying flat on the path again. Sobbing. Snot was running from his nose in thick green streams. With one hand, he was feebly trying to rub some feeling back into his numb ass. Bobby's hands tightened on the taped handle of the bat again. He wanted to lift it and bring it down one final time. Not on Harry's shin or Harry's backside, but on Harry's head. He wanted to hear the crunch of Harry's skull, and really, wouldn't the world be a better place without him, little Irish shit? Low, little...
Steady on, Bobby. Ted's voice spoke up. Enough is enough, so just steady on. Control yourself.
Touch her again and I'll kill you, Bobby said. Touch me again. I'll burn your house down. You fucking Nimrod. He had squatted by Harry to say this last. Now he got up, looked around, and walked away. By the time he met the Sigsby twins halfway up Broad Street Hill, he was whistling. In the years which followed, Liz Garfield almost got used to seeing policemen at her door. The first to show up was Officer Raymer, the fat local cop who would sometimes buy the kids peanuts from the guy in the park. When he rang the doorbell of the ground floor apartment at 149 Broad Street on the evening of August 6th, Officer Raymer didn't look happy. With him was Harry Doolin, who would not be able to sit in an uncushioned seat for a week or more, and his mother, Mary Doolin. Harry mounted the porch steps like an old man, with his hands planted in the small of his back. When Liz opened the front door, Bobby was by her side. Mary Doolin pointed at him and cried, "That's him, that's the boy who beat up my Harry. Arrest him. Do your duty." "What's this about, George?" Liz asked. For a moment, Officer Raymer didn't reply. He looked from Bobby, 5 feet, 4 inches tall, 97 pounds, to Harry, 6 feet, 1 inch tall, 175 pounds, instead. His large, moist eyes were doubtful. Harry Doolin was stupid, but not so stupid he couldn't read that look. "He snuck up on me, got me from behind." Raymer bent down to Bobby with his chapped, red-knuckled hands on the shiny knees of his uniform pants. "Harry Doolin here claims you beat him up in the park whilst he was on his way home from Rourke." Raymer pronounced work as Rourke. Bobby never forgot that. "Says you hid and then lumped him up with a ball bat before he could even turn around. What do you say, laddie? Is he telling the truth?" Bobby, not stupid at all, had already considered this scene. He wished he could have told Harry in the park that paid was paid and done was done, that if Harry tattled anyone about Bobby beating him up, then Bobby would tattle right back, would tell about Harry and his friends hurting Carol, which would look much worse. The trouble with that was that Harry's friends would deny it. It would be Carol's word against Harry's, Richie's, and Willie's. So Bobby had walked away without saying anything, hoping that Harry's humiliation, beat up by a little kid half his size, would keep his mouth shut. It hadn't, and looking at Mrs. Doolin's narrow face, pinched, paintless lips, and furious eyes, Bobby knew why. She had gotten it out of him, that was all. Nagged it out of him, more than likely. "I never touched him," Bobby told Raymer, and met Raymer's gaze firmly with his own as he said it. Mary Doolin gasped, shocked. Even Harry, to whom lying must have been a way of life by the age of 16, looked surprised.
"Oh, the straight-out barefacedness of it!" Mrs. Doolin cried. "You let me talk to him, officer. I'll get the truth out of him, see if I don't."
She started forward. Raymer swept her back with one hand, not rising or even taking his eyes off Bobby. "Now, lad, why would a galoot the size of Harry Doolin say such a thing about a shrimp the size of you if it wasn't true?"
"Don't you be calling my boy a galoot!" Mrs. Doolin shrilled. "Ain't it enough he's been beat within an inch of his life by this coward? Why—"
"Shut up," Bobby's mom said. It was the first time she'd spoken since asking Officer Raymer what this was about, and her voice was deadly quiet. "Let him answer the question." "He's still mad at me from last winter, that's why," Bobby told Raymer. "He and some other big kids from St. Gabe's chased me down the hill. Harry slipped on the ice and fell down and got all wet. He said he'd get me. I guess he thinks this is a good way to do it."
"You liar," Harry shouted. "That wasn't me who chased you. That was Billy Donahue, that—"
He stopped, looked around. He'd put his foot in it somehow. A dim appreciation of the fact was dawning on his face. "It wasn't me," Bobby said. He spoke quietly, holding Raymer's eyes. "If I tried to beat up a kid his size, he'd total me.
Liars go to hell! Mary Doolin shouted.
Where were you around 3:30 this afternoon, Bobby? Raymer asked. Can you answer me that?
Here, Bobby said.
Miss Garfield. Oh, yes, she said calmly. Right here with me all afternoon. I washed the kitchen floor and Bobby cleaned the baseboards. We're getting ready to move, and I want the place to look nice when we do. Bobby complained a little, as boys will do, but he did his chore, and afterward we had iced tea.
Lawyer! Mrs. Doolin cried. Harry only looked stunned. Shocking lawyer!
She lunged forward again, hands reaching in the general direction of Liz Garfield's neck. Once more, Officer Raymer pushed her back without looking at her, a bit more roughly this time.
You tell me on your oath that he was with you? Officer Raymer asked Liz.
On my oath.
Bobby, you never touched him? On your oath?
On my oath.
On your oath? Before God?
On my oath before God.
I'm going to get you, Garfield, Harry said. I'm going to fix your little red wet.
Raymer swung around so suddenly that if his mother hadn't seized him by one elbow, Harry might have tumbled down the porch steps, re-injuring himself in old places and opening fresh wounds in new ones.
Shut your ugly, stupid pot, Raymer said,
and when Mrs. Doolin started to speak, Raymer pointed at her.
Shut yours as well, Mary Doolin. Maybe if you want to bring beating charges against someone, you ought to start with your own damned husband. There'd be more witnesses.
She gawped at him, furious and ashamed. Raymer dropped the hand he'd been pointing with as if it had suddenly gained weight. He gazed from Harry and Mary, neither full of grace, on the porch to Bobby and Liz in the foyer. Then he stepped back from all four, took off his uniform cap, scratched his sweaty head, and put his cap back on.
Something's rotten in the state of Denmark, he said at last. Someone here is lying faster than a horse can trot.
Harry and Bobby spoke together, but Officer George Raymer was interested in hearing from neither.
Shut up!
He roared,
loud enough to make an old couple strolling past on the other side of the street turn and look.
I'm declaring the case closed, but if there's any more trouble between the two of you, pointing at the boys, or you, pointing at the mothers, there's going to be woe for someone. A word to the wise is sufficient, they say. Harry, will you shake young Robert's hand and say all's well? Do the manly thing?
Ah, I thought not. The world's a sad goddamn place. Come on, Doolins. I'll see you home.
Bobby and his mother watched the three of them go down the steps, Harry's limp now exaggerated to the point of a sailor's stagger. At the foot of the walk, Mrs. Doolin suddenly cuffed him on the back of the neck.
Don't make it worse than it is, you little shite, she said.
Harry did better after that, but he still rolled from starboard to port. To Bobby, the boy's residual limp looked like the goods. Probably was the goods. That last lick, the one across Harry's ass, had been a grand slam. Back in the apartment, speaking in that same calm voice, Liz asked, was he one of the boys that hurt Carol?
Yes.
Can you stay out of his way until we move?
I think so.
Good, she said, and then kissed him. She hardly ever kissed him, and it was wonderful when she did. Less than a week before they moved, the apartment had by then begun to fill up with cardboard boxes and to take on a strange, denuded look. Bobby caught up to Carol Gerber in the park. She was walking along by herself for a change. He had seen her out walking with her girlfriends plenty of times, but that wasn't good enough, wasn't what he wanted. Now she was finally alone, and it wasn't until she looked over her shoulder at him and he saw the fear in her eyes that he knew she had been avoiding him. Bobby, she said, how are you? I don't know, he said. Okay, I guess. I haven't seen you around.
You haven't come up my house.
No, he said. No, I...
What? How was he supposed to finish?
I've been pretty busy, he said lamely.
Oh. Uh-huh.
He could have handled her being cool to him. What he couldn't handle was the fear she was trying to hide. The fear of him, as if he was a dog that might bite her.
Bobby had a crazy image of himself dropping down on all fours and starting to go, roo, roo, roo. I'm moving away. Sully told me, but he didn't know exactly where. I guess you guys don't chum like you used to. No, Bobby said, not like we used to. But here. He reached into his back pocket and brought out a piece of folded over paper from a school notebook. Carol looked at it doubtfully, reached for it, then pulled her hand back. It's just my address, he said. We're going to Massachusetts, a town named Danvers. Bobby held out the folded paper, but she still wasn't taking it, and he felt like crying. He remembered being at the top of the Ferris wheel with her, and how it was like being at the top of the whole lighted world. He remembered a towel opening like wings, feet with tiny painted toes pivoting, and the smell of perfume. She's dancing to the drag, the cha-cha rag-em-up, Freddie Cannon sang from the radio in the other room, and it was Carol. It was Carol. It was Carol. I thought you might write, he said. I'll probably be homesick, a new town and all. Carol took the paper at last and put it into the pocket of her shorts without looking at it. Probably throw it away when she gets home, Bobby thought, but he didn't care. She had taken it, at least. That would be enough springboard for those times when he needed to take his mind away. And there didn't have to be any low men in the vicinity for you to need to do that, he had discovered. Sully says you're different now. Bobby didn't reply. Lots of people say that, actually. Bobby didn't reply. Did you beat Harry Doolin up? She asked and gripped Bobby's wrist with a cold hand. Did you? Bobby slowly nodded his head. Carol threw her arms around his neck and kissed him so hard their teeth clashed. Their mouths parted with an audible smack. Bobby didn't kiss another girl on the mouth for 3 years, and never in his life did he have one kiss him like that.
Good. She said in a low, fierce voice. It was almost a growl.
Good.
Then she ran toward Broad Street, her legs browned with summer and scabbed by many games and many sidewalks, flashing.
Carol, he called after her. Carol, wait.
She ran.
Carol, I love you.
She stopped at that. Maybe it was just that she'd reached Commonwealth Avenue and had to look for traffic. In any case, she paused a moment, head lowered, and then looked back. Her eyes were wide and her lips were parted.
Carol! I have to go home. I have to make the salad, she said,
and ran away from him. She ran across the street and out of his life without looking back a second time. Perhaps that was just as well. Mom moved to Danvers. Bobby went to Danvers Elementary, made some friends, made even more enemies. The fights started, and not long after so did the truancies. On the comments section of his first report card, Mrs. Rivers wrote, Robert is an extremely bright boy. He is also extremely troubled. Will you come and see me about him, Mrs. Garfield? Mrs. Garfield went, and Mrs. Garfield helped as much as she could, but there were too many things about which she could not speak. Providence, a certain lost pet poster, and how she'd come by the money she'd used to buy into a new business and a new life. The two women agreed that Bobby was suffering from growing pains, that he was missing his old town and old friends as well. He would eventually outlast his troubles. He was too bright and too full of potential not to. Liz prospered in her new career as a real estate agent. Bobby did well enough in English. He got an A-plus on a paper in which he compared Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men to Golding's Lord of the Flies. and did poorly in the rest of his classes. He began to smoke cigarettes.
Carol did write from time to time, hesitant, almost tentative notes in which she talked about school and friends and the weekend trip to New York City with Rianda. Appended to one that arrived in March of 1961, her letters always came on decal-edged paper with teddy bears dancing down the sides, was a stark P.S. I think my mom and dad are going to get a divorce. He signed up for another hitch, and all she does is cry. Mostly, however, she stuck to brighter things. She was learning to twirl. She had gotten new skates on her birthday. She still thought Fabian was cute, even if Yvonne and Tina didn't. She had been to a twist party and danced every dance. As he opened each of her letters and pulled it out, Bobby would think, "This is the last. I won't hear from her again. Kids don't write letters for long, even if they promise they will. There are too many new things coming along. Time goes by so fast, too fast. She'll forget me." But he would not help her to do so. After each of her letters came, he would sit down and write a response. He told her about the house in Brookline his mother sold for $25,000, 6 months' salary at her old job and a single commission. He told her about the A-plus on his English theme. He told her about his friend Maury, who was teaching him to play chess. He didn't tell her that sometimes he and Maury went on window-breaking expeditions, riding their bikes — Bobby finally had saved up enough to buy one — as fast as they could past the scuzzy old apartment houses on Plymouth Street, and throwing rocks out of their baskets as they went. He skipped the story of how he had told Mr. Hurley, the assistant principal at Danvers Elementary, to kiss his rosy red ass, and how Mr. Hurley had responded by slapping him across the face and calling him an insolent, wearisome little boy. He didn't confide that he had begun shoplifting, or that he had been drunk 4 or 5 times, once with Maury, the other times by himself, or that sometimes he walked over to the train tracks and wondered if getting run over by the South Shore Express would be the quickest way to finish the job. Just a whiff of diesel fuel, a shadow falling over your face, and then bluey. Or maybe not that quick. Each letter he wrote to Carol ended the same way. "You are sadly missed by your friend, Bobby." Weeks would pass with no mail, not for him. And then there would be another envelope with hearts and teddy bears stuck to the back, another sheet of decal-edged paper, more stuff about skating and baton twirling and new shoes and how she was still stuck on fractions. Each letter was like one more labored breath from a loved one whose death now seemed inevitable. One more breath. Even Sully John wrote him a few letters. They stopped early in 1961, but Bobby was amazed and touched that Sully would try at all. In S.J.'s childishly big handwriting and painful misspellings, Bobby could make out the approach of a good-hearted teenage boy who would play sports and lay cheerleaders with equal joy, a boy who would become lost in the thickets of punctuation as easily as he would weave through the defensive lines of opposing football teams. Bobby thought he could even see the man who was waiting for Sully up ahead in the 70s and 80s, waiting for him the way you'd wait for a taxi to arrive, a car salesman who'd eventually own his own dealership, Honest John's, of course, Honest John's, Harwich Chevrolet. He'd have a big stomach hanging over his belt and lots of plaques on the wall of his office, and he'd coach youth sports and start every pep talk with "Listen up, guys," and go to church and march in parades and be on the city council and all that. It would be a good life, Bobby reckoned. The farm and the rabbits instead of the stick, sharpened at both ends. Although, for Sully, the stick turned out to be waiting after all. It was waiting in Dong Ha Province, along with the old Mama-san, the one who would never completely go away. Bobby was 14 when the cop caught him coming out of the convenience store with 2 six-packs of beer, Narragansett, and 3 cartons of cigarettes, Chesterfields, naturally. 21 great tobaccos make 20 wonderful smokes. This was the blonde village of the damned cop. Bobby told the cop he hadn't broken in, that the back door was open. He just walked in. But when the cop shone his flashlight on the lock, it hung askew in the old wood, half gouged out. "What about this?" the cop asked, and Bobby shrugged. Sitting in the car, the cop let Bobby sit in the front seat with him, but wouldn't let him have a butt when Bobby asked. The cop began filling out a form on a clipboard. He asked the sullen, skinny kid beside him what his name was. "Ralph," Bobby said. Ralph Garfield. But when they pulled up in front of the house where he now lived with his mom, a whole house, upstairs and downstairs, both times were good, he told the cop he had lied. "My name's really Jack," he said. "Oh, yeah?" the blonde village of the damned cop said. "Yes," Bobby said, nodding. "Jack Merridew Garfield. That's me." Carol Gerber's letters stopped coming in 1963, which happened to be the year of Bobby's first school expulsion and also the year of his first visit to Massachusetts Youth Correctional in Bedford. The cause of this visit was possession of 5 marijuana cigarettes, which Bobby and his friends called joysticks. Bobby was sentenced to 90 days, the last 30 forgiven for good behavior. He read a lot of books. Some of the other kids called him Professor. Bobby didn't mind. When he got out of Bedbug Correctional, Officer Grandel, the Danvers juvenile officer, came by and asked if Bobby was ready to straighten up and fly right. Bobby said he was. He had learned his lesson, and for a while that seemed to be true. Then, in the fall of 1964, he beat a boy so badly that the boy had to go to the hospital, and there was some question of whether or not he would completely recover. The kid wouldn't give Bobby his guitar, so Bobby beat him up and took it. Bobby was playing the guitar, not very well, in his room when he was arrested. He had told Liz he'd bought the guitar, a Silvertone acoustic in a pawn shop. Liz stood weeping in the doorway as Officer Grandel led Bobby to the police car parked at the curb. "I'm going to wash my hands of you if you don't stop," she cried after him. "I mean it, I do." "Wash him," he said, getting in the back. "Go ahead, Ma, wash him now and save time." "Driving downtown," Officer Grandel said, "I thought you was going to straighten up and fly right, Bobby." "Me too," Bobby said. That time he was in Bedbug for 6 months. When he got out, he cashed in his Trailways ticket and hitched home. When he let himself into the house, his mother didn't come out to greet him. "You got a letter," she said from her darkened bedroom. "It's on your desk." Bobby's heart began to bang hard against his ribs as soon as he saw the envelope. The hearts and teddy bears were gone. She was too old for them now. But he recognized Carol's handwriting at once. He picked up the letter and tore it open. Inside was a single sheet of paper, decal-edged, and another, smaller envelope. Bobby read Carol's note, the last he ever received from her, quickly. "Dear Bobby, how are you? I am fine. You got something from your old friend, the one who fixed my arm that time. It came to me because I guess he didn't know where you were. He put a note in asking me to send it along. So I am. Say hi to your mom. Carol." No news of her adventures in twirling. No news of how she was doing with math. No news of boyfriends either, but Bobby guessed she probably had had a few. He picked up the sealed envelope with hands that were shaky and numb. His heart was pounding harder than ever. On the front, written in soft pencil, was a single word, his name. It was Ted's handwriting. He knew it at once. Dry-mouthed, unaware that his eyes had filled with tears, Bobby tore open the envelope, which was no bigger than the ones in which children send their first-grade valentines. What came out first was the sweetest smell Bobby had ever experienced. It made him think of hugging his mother when he was small. The smell of her perfume and deodorant and the stuff she put on her hair. It made him think of how Commonwealth Park smelled in the summer. It made him think of how the Harwich Library stacks had smelled spicy and dim and somehow explosive. The tears in his eyes overspilled and began to run down his cheeks. He'd gotten used to feeling old.
feeling young again, knowing he could feel young again. It was a terrible, disorienting shock. There was no letter, no note, no writing of any kind. When Bobby tilted the envelope, what showered down on the surface of his desk were rose petals of the deepest, darkest red he had ever seen. Heart's blood, he thought, exalted without knowing why. All at once, and for the first time in years, he remembered how you could take your mind away, how you could just put it on parole. And even as he thought of it, he felt his thoughts lifting. The rose petals gleamed on the scarred surface of his desk like rubies, like secret light spilled from the world's secret heart. Not just one world, Bobby thought. Not just one. There are other worlds than this. Millions of worlds, all turning on the spindle of the tower. And then he thought, he got away from them again. He's free again. The petals left no room for doubt. They were all the yes anyone could ever need. All the you may, all the you can, all the it's true. Now they go, now they slow, Bobby thought, knowing he had heard those words before, not remembering where, or knowing why they had recurred to him now, not caring either. Ted was free. Not in this world and time. This time he had run in another direction, but in some world. Bobby scooped up the petals, each one like a tiny silk coin. He cupped them like palmfuls of blood, then raised them to his face. He could have drowned in their sweet reek. Ted was in them. Ted, clear as day, with his funny stooped way of walking, his baby fine white hair and the yellow nicotine stains tattooed on the first two fingers of his right hand. Ted, with his carry-handled shopping bags. As on the day when he had punished Harry Doolin for hurting Carol, he heard Ted's voice. Then it had been mostly imagination. This time, Bobby thought it was real, something which had been embedded in the rose petals and left for him.
Steady on, Bobby. Enough is enough, so just steady on. Control yourself.
He sat at his desk for a long time with the rose petals pressed to his face. At last, careful not to lose a single one, he put them back into the little envelope and folded down the torn top.
He's free. He's
somewhere. And he remembered.
He remembered me, Bobby said. He remembered me.
He got up, went into the kitchen, and put on the tea kettle. Then he went into his mother's room. She was on her bed, lying there in her slip with her feet up, and he could see she had started to look old. She turned her face away from him when he sat down next to her, a boy now almost as big as a man. But she let him take her hand. He held it and stroked it and waited for the kettle to whistle. After a while, she turned to look at him.
Oh, Bobby, she said, we've made such a mess of things, you and me. What are we gonna do? The best we can, he said, still stroking her hand. He raised it to his lips and kissed the palm where her lifeline and heartline tangled briefly before wandering away from each other again. Best we can.
...1966. Man, we just couldn't stop laughing. Hearts in Atlantis. When I came to the University of Maine in 1966, there was still a Goldwater sticker, tattered and faded but perfectly readable, AUH2O for USA, on the old station wagon I inherited from my brother. When I left the university in 1970, I had no car. What I did have was a beard, hair down on my shoulders, and a backpack with a sticker on it reading, Richard Nixon is a war criminal. The button on the collar of my denim jacket read, I ain't no fortunate son. College is always a time of change, I guess, the last major convulsion of childhood. But I doubt there were ever changes of such magnitude as those faced by the students who came to their campuses in the late 60s. Most of us don't say much about those years now, not because we don't remember them, but because the language which we spoke back then has been lost. When I try to talk about the 60s, when I even try to think about them, I am overcome by horror and hilarity. I see bell-bottom pants and earth shoes. I smell pot and patchouli, incense and peppermints. And I hear Donovan Leitch singing his sweet and stupid song about the continent of Atlantis, lyrics that still seem profound to me in the watches of the night when I can't sleep. The older I get, the harder it is to let go of that song's stupidity and hold on to its sweetness. I have to remind myself that we were smaller then, small enough to live our brightly hued lives under the mushrooms, all the time believing them to be trees, shelter from the sheltering sky. I know that doesn't make any real sense, but it's the best I can do. Hail Atlantis. I finished my senior year living off campus in LSD Acres, the rotting cabins down by the Stillwater River. But when I came to U of M in 1966, I lived in Chamberlain Hall, which was part of a three-dorm complex. Chamberlain, men, King, men, and Franklin, women. There was also a dining hall, Holyoke Commons, which stood a little apart from the dorms. Not far, perhaps only an eighth of a mile, but it seemed far on winter nights when the wind was strong and the temperature dipped below zero. Far enough so that Holyoke was known as the Palace on the Plains. I learned a lot in college, the very least of it in the classrooms. I learned how to kiss a girl and put on a rubber at the same time, a necessary but often overlooked skill. how to chug a 16-ounce can of beer without throwing up, how to make extra cash in my spare time, writing term papers for kids with more money than I, which was most of them, how not to be a Republican, even though I had sprung from a long line of them, how to go into the streets with a sign held up over my head chanting, 1, 2, 3, 4, we won't fight your fucking war, and, hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? I learned that you should try to get downwind of tear gas and breathe slowly through a handkerchief or a bandana if you couldn't do that. I learned that when the nightsticks come out, you want to fall on your side, draw your knees up to your chest, and cover the back of your head with your hands. In Chicago, in 1968, I learned that the cops can beat the shit out of you no matter how well you cover up. But before I learned any of those things, I learned about the pleasures and dangers of hearts. There were 16 rooms holding 32 boys on the third floor of Chamberlain Hall in the fall of 1966. By January of 1967, 19 of those boys had either moved or flunked out, victims of hearts. It swept through us that fall like a virulent strain of influenza. Only 3 of the young men on 3 were completely immune, I think. One was my roommate, Nathan Hoppenstand. One was David Deary Dearborn, the floor proctor. The third was Stokely Jones III, soon to be known to the citizenry of Chamberlain Hall as Rip Rip. Sometimes I think it's Rip Rip I want to tell you about. Sometimes I think it's Skip Kirk, later known as Captain Kirk, of course, who was my best friend during those years. Sometimes I think it's Carol. Often I believe it's the 60s themselves I want to talk about, impossible as that has always seemed to me. But before I talk about any of those things, I better tell you about hearts. Skip once said that whist is bridge for dopes, and hearts is bridge for real dopes. You'll get no argument from me, although that kind of misses the point. Hearts is fun, that's the point, and when you play it for money, a nickel point was the going rate on Chamberlain 3, it quickly becomes compulsive. The ideal number of players is 4. All the cards are dealt out and then played in tricks. Each hand amounts to 26 total points, 13 hearts at a point each, and the queen of spades, which we call the bitch, worth 13 points all by herself. The game ends when one of the 4 players tops 100 points. The winner is the player with the lowest score. In our marathons, each of the other 3 players would cough up based on the difference between his score and the winner's score. If, for example, the difference between my score and Skip's was 20 points at the end of the game, I had to pay him $1 at the going rate of a nickel a point. Chump change, you'd say now, but this was 1966, and $1 wasn't just change to the work-study chumps who lived on Chamberlain 3. I recall quite clearly when the hearts epidemic started, the first weekend in October. I remember because the semester's initial round of prelims had just ended, and I had survived. Survival was an actual issue for most of the boys on Chamberlain 3. We were at college thanks to a variety of scholarships, loans, most including my own, courtesy of the National Education Defense Act, and work-study jobs. It was like riding in a soapbox derby car which had been put together with paste instead of nails, and while our arrangements varied, mostly according to how crafty we were when it came to filling out forms and how diligently our high school guidance counselors had worked for us, there was one hard fact of life. It was summed up by a sampler which hung in the third floor lounge where our marathon hearts tournaments were played. Tony DeLuca's mother made it, told him to hang it someplace where he'd see it every day, and sent him off to college with it. As the fall of 1966 wore out and winter replaced it, Mrs. DeLuca's sampler seemed to glare bigger and brighter with each passing hand, each fall of the bitch, each night I rolled into bed with my textbooks unopened, my notes unstudied, my papers unwritten. Once or twice I even dreamed about it. 2.5. That's what the sampler said, in big red crocheted numerals. Mrs. DeLuca understood what it meant, and so did we. If you lived in one of the ordinary dorms, Jacqueline or Dunn or Pease or Chadbourne, you could keep your place in the class of 1970 with a 1.6 average. If that was, Daddy and Mummy continued to pay the bills. This was a state land-grant college, remember. We are not talking about Harvard or Wellesley. For students trying to stagger through on scholarship and loan packages, however, 2.5 was the line drawn in the dust. Score below a 2.5, drop from a C average to a C minus, in other words, and your little soapbox racer was almost certain to fall apart. Be in touch, baby. See ya, as Skip Kirk used to say. I did okay on that first round of prelims, especially for a boy who was almost ill with homesickness. I had never been away from home in my life, except for a single week at basketball camp, from which I returned with a sprained wrist and an odd fungal growth between my toes and under my testes. I was carrying 5 subjects and got B's in everything except freshman English. On that one, I got an A. My instructor, who would later divorce his wife and wind up busking in Sproul Plaza on the Berkeley campus, wrote, "Your example of onomatopoeia is actually quite brilliant," beside one of my answers. I sent that test back home to my mother and father. My mother returned a postcard with one word, "Bravo," scrawled fervently across the back. Remembering that causes an unexpected pang, something actually close to physical pain. It was, I suppose, the last time I dragged home a school paper with a gold star pasted in the corner. After that first round of prelims, I complacently calculated my GPA in progress and came out with a 3.3. It never got near that again, and by late December I realized that the choices had become very simple. Quit playing cards and maybe survive to the next semester with my fragile financial aid package intact, or continue bitch hunting beneath Mrs. DeLuca's sampler in the third floor lounge until Christmas and then head back to Gates Falls for good. I'd be able to get a job at Gates Falls Mills and Weaving. My father had been there for 20 years, right up until the accident that cost him his sight, and he'd get me in. My mother would hate it, but she wouldn't stand in the way if I told her it was what I wanted. At the end of the day, she was always the realest of the family. Even when her hopes and disappointments ran her half mad, she was a realist. For a while, she'd be grief-stricken at my failure to make a go of it at the university, and for a while, I'd be guilt-ridden, but we'd both get over it. I wanted to be a writer, after all, not a damned English teacher, and I had an idea that only pompous writers needed college to do what they did. Yet I didn't want to flunk out, either. It seemed the wrong way to start my life as a grown-up. It smelled like failure, and all my Whitman-esque ruminations about how a writer should do his work among the people smelled like a rationalization for that failure. And still, the third-floor lounge called to me. The snap of the cards, someone asking if this hand was a pass left or a pass right, someone else asking who had the douche. A hand of hearts begins by playing the 2 of clubs, a card known to us third-floor addicts as the douche. I had dreams in which Ronnie Malenfant, the first true bread-in-the-bone asshole I had met since escaping the bullies of junior high, began to play spades one after another, screaming, "Time to go bitch hunting, we chasing the cunt!" in his high-pitched, reedy voice. We almost always see where our best interest lies, I think. But sometimes what we see means very little compared to what we feel. Tough but true. My roommate didn't play hearts. My roommate didn't have any use for the undeclared war in Vietnam. My roommate wrote home to his girlfriend, a senior at Wisdom Consolidated High School, every day. Put a glass of water next to Nate Hoppenstand, and it was the water that looked vivacious. He and I lived in room 302, next to the stairwell, across from the proctor's suite, lair of the hideous Deary, and all the way down the hall from the lounge with its card tables, stand-up ashtrays, and its view of the palace on the plains. Our pairing suggested, to me at least, that everyone's most macabre musings about the university housing office might well be true, On the questionnaire, which I had returned to housing in April of 66, when my biggest concern was deciding where I should take Anne-Marie Susie to eat after the senior prom, I had said that I was A, a smoker, B, a young Republican, C, an aspiring folk guitarist, D, a night owl. In its dubious wisdom, the housing office paired me with Nate, a non-smoking dentist in progress whose folks were Aroostook County Democrats. The fact that Lyndon Johnson was a Democrat made Nate feel no better about U.S. soldiers running around South Vietnam. I had a poster of Humphrey Bogart above my bed. Above his, Nate hung photos of his dog and his girl. The girl was a sallow creature dressed in a wisdom-high majorette's uniform and clutching a baton like a cudgel. She was Cindy. The dog was Rinty. Both the girl and the dog were sporting identical grins. It was fucking surreal. Nate's worst failing, as far as Skip and I were concerned, was the collection of record albums he kept carefully shelved in alphabetical order below Cindy and Rinty and just above his nifty little RCA swingline phonograph. He had 3 Mitch Miller records, Sing Along with Mitch, More Sing Along with Mitch, Mitch and the Gang Sing John Henry and Other American Folk Favorites. Meet Trini Lopez, a Dean Martin LP, Dino Swings Vegas, a Jerry and the Pacemakers LP, the first Dave Clark 5 album, perhaps the noisiest bad rock record ever made, and many others of the same ilk. I can't remember them all. It's probably a good thing. Nate, no, Skip said one evening. Oh, please, no. This was shortly before the onset of Hart's mania, perhaps only days. Oh, please, no what? Nate asked, without looking up from what he was doing at his desk. He seemed to spend all his waking hours either in class or at that desk. Sometimes I would catch him picking his nose and surreptitiously wiping the gleanings, after careful and thorough inspections, under the middle drawer. It was his only vice, if you accepted his horrible taste in music, that was. Skip had been inspecting Nate's albums, something he did with absolutely no self-consciousness in every kid's room he visited. Now he was holding one up. He had the look of a doctor studying a bad X-ray, one that shows a juicy and almost certainly malignant tumor. He was standing between Nate's bed and mine, wearing his high school letter jacket and a Dexter High School baseball cap. Never in college, and rarely since, have I met a man I thought so American Pie handsome as the captain. Skip seemed unaware of his good looks, but he couldn't have been, not entirely, or he wouldn't have gotten laid as often as he did. It was a time when almost anybody could get laid, of course, but even by the standards of the time, Skip was busy. None of that had started in the fall of 66, though. In the fall of 66, Skip's heart, like mine, would belong to Hart's. "This is bad, little buddy," Skip said in a gentle, chiding voice. "Sorry, but this bites." I was sitting at my own desk, smoking a Pall Mall and looking for my meal ticket. I was always losing the fucking thing. "What bites? Why are you looking at my records?" Nate's botany text was open in front of him. He was drawing a leaf on a piece of graph paper. His blue freshman beanie was cocked back on his head. Nate Hoppenstand was, I believe, the only member of the freshman class who actually wore that stupid blue dish rag until Maine's hapless football team finally scored a touchdown, a week or so before Thanksgiving, that was. Skip went on studying the record album. "This sucks the rigid cock of Satan. It really does." "I hate it when you talk that way," Nate exclaimed, but still too stubborn to actually look up. Skip knew Nate hated him to talk that way, which was why he did it. "What are you talking about, anyway?" "I'm sorry my language offends you, but I don't withdraw the comment. I can't, 'cause this is bad. It hurts me, little buddy. It fucking hurts me." "What?" Nate finally looked up, irritated, away from his leaf, which was marked as carefully as a map in a Rand McNally road atlas. "What?" "This." On the album cover Skip was holding, a girl with a perky face and perky little breasts poking out the front of a midi blouse appeared to be dancing on the deck of a PT boat. One hand was raised, palm out, in a perky little wave. Cocked on her head was a perky little sailor's hat. I bet you're the only college student in America that brought Diane Renee Sings Navy Blue to school with him, Skip said. It's wrong, Nate. This belongs back in your attic, along with the wiener pants I bet you wore to all the high school pep rallies and church socials. If wiener pants meant polyester Sansevelt slacks with that weird and purposeless little buckle in the back, I suspected Nate had brought most of his collection with him. Was, in fact, wearing a pair at that very moment. I said nothing, though. I picked up a framed picture of my own girlfriend and spied my meal ticket behind it. I grabbed it and stuffed it in the pocket of my Levi's. "That's a good record," Nate said with dignity. "That's a very good record. It swings." "Swings, does it?" Skip asked, tossing it back onto Nate's bed. He refused to reshelf Nate's records because he knew it drove Nate bugfuck. "My steady boy said ship ahoy and joined the Navy. If that fits your definition of good, remind me to never let you give me a fucking physical." "I'm going to be a dentist, not a doctor," Nate said, clipping off each word. Cords were beginning to stand out on his neck. So far as I know, Skip Kirk was the only person in Chamberlain Hall, maybe on the whole campus, who could get under my roomie's thick Yankee skin. "I'm in pre-dent. Do you know what the dent in pre-dent means? It means teeth, Skip. It means..." "Remind me to never let you fill one of my fucking cavities." "Why do you have to say that all the time?" "What?" Skip asked, knowing, but wanting Nate to say it. Nate eventually would, and his face always turned bright red when he finally did. This fascinated Skip. Everything about Nate fascinated Skip. The captain once told me he was pretty sure Nate was an alien, beamed down from the planet Good Boy. "Fuck," Nate Hoppenstein said, and immediately his cheeks became rosy. In a few moments he looked like a Dickens character, some earnest young man sketched by Boz. "That." "I had bad role models," Skip said. "I dread to think about your future, Nate. What if Paul Anka makes a fucking comeback?" "You've never heard this record," Nate said, snatching up Diane Renee Sings Navy Blue from the bed and putting it back between Mitch Miller and Stella Stevens Is in Love. "Never fucking want to, either," Skip said. "Come on, Pete, let's eat. I'm fucking starving." I picked up my geology text. There was a quiz coming up the following Tuesday. Skip took it out of my hand and slung it back onto the desk, knocking over the picture of my girlfriend, who wouldn't fuck, but who would give a slow, excruciatingly pleasant hand job when she was in the mood. Nobody gives a hand job like a Catholic girl. I've changed my mind about a lot of things in the course of my life, but never about that. "What did you do that for?" I asked. "You don't read at the fucking table," he said. "Not even when you're eating common slop. What kind of barn were you born in?" "Actually, Skip, I was born into a family where people do read at the table. I know it's hard for you to believe there could be any way of doing things except for the Kirk way of doing them, but there is." He looked unexpectedly grave. He took me by the forearms, looked into my eyes, and said, "At least don't study when you eat, okay?" "Okay." Mentally reserving the right to study whenever I fucking well pleased or felt I needed to. "Get into all that ram-drive behavior and you'll get ulcers. Ulcers are what killed my old man. He just couldn't stop ramming and driving." "Oh," I said. "Sorry." "Don't worry, it was a long time ago. Now come on, before all the fucking tuna surprise is gone. Coming, Nate Bow?" "I have to finish this leaf." "Fuck the leaf." If anyone else had said this to him, Nate would have looked at him as at something uncovered beneath a rotten log, and turned silently back to his work. In this case, Nate considered for a moment, then got up and took his jacket carefully off the back of the door, where he always hung it. He put it on. He adjusted the beanie on his head. Not even Skip dared say much about Nate's stubborn refusal to stop wearing his freshman beanie. When I asked Skip where his own had disappeared to, this was our third day at UM and the day after I met him, he said, "Wipe my ass with it," and threw the fucker up a tree. This was probably not the truth, but I have never completely ruled it out either. We clattered down the three flights of stairs and went out into the mild October dusk. From all three dorms, students were headed toward Holyoke Commons, where I worked 9 meals a week. I was a dish line boy, recently promoted from silverware boy. If I kept my nose clean, I'd be a stack boy before the Thanksgiving break. Chamberlain, King, and Franklin Halls were on high ground. So was the Palace on the Plains. To reach it, students took asphalt paths that dipped into a hollow like a long trough, then joined into one broad brick way and climbed again. Holyoke was the biggest of the four buildings, shining in the gloom like a cruise ship on the ocean. The dip where the asphalt paths met was known as Bennett's Run. If I ever knew why, I have long since forgotten. Boys from King and Chamberlain came along two of these paths, girls from Franklin along the other. Where the paths joined, boys and girls did likewise, talking and laughing and exchanging looks both frank and shy. From there they moved together up the wide brick path known as Bennett's Walk to the Commons building. Coming the other way, cutting back through the crowd with his head down and the usual closed-off expression on his pale, harsh face, was Stokely Jones III. He was tall, but you hardly realized it because he was always hunched over his crutches. His hair, a perfect glossy black with not so much as a single observable strand of anything lighter, spilled over his forehead in spikes, hid his ears, inked a few stray strands diagonally across his pale cheeks. This was the heyday of the beetle haircut, which for most boys consisted of no more than combing carefully down instead of carefully up, thus hiding the forehead and a good crop of pimples more often than not. Stoke Jones was capped off by nothing so prissy. His medium-length hair just went where it wanted to. His back was hunched in a way that would soon be permanent, if it wasn't already. His eyes were usually cast down, seeming to trace the arcs of his crutches. If those eyes happened to rise and meet your own, you were apt to be startled by their wild intelligence. He was a New England Heathcliff, only wasted away to a bare scrawn from the hips down. His legs, which were usually encased in huge metal braces when he went to class, could move, but only feebly, like the tentacles of a dying squid. His upper body was brawny by comparison. The combination was bizarre. Stoke Jones was a Charles Atlas ad in which before and after had somehow been melted into the same body. He ate every meal as soon as Holyoke opened, and even 3 weeks into our first semester, we all knew he did it, not because he was one of the handicaps, but because he wanted, like Greta Garbo, to be alone. "Fuck him," Ronnie Malenfant said while we were on our way to breakfast one day. He had just said hello to Jones, and Jones had simply crutched his way past without even a nod. He'd been muttering under his breath, though. We all heard it. "Crippled up hopping asshole." That was Ronnie, always sympathetic. I guess it was growing up amid the puke-in-the-corner beer joints on Lower Lisbon Street in Lewiston that gave him his grace and charm and joie de vivre. "Stoke, what's up?" Skip asked on this particular evening as Jones plunged toward us on his crutches. Stoke went everywhere at that same controlled plunge, always with his Bluto-Blutarski upper half leaning forward so that he looked like a ship's figurehead, Stoke continually saying "fuck you" to whatever it was that had creamed his lower half, Stoke continually giving it the finger, Stoke looking at you with his smart, wild eyes and saying "fuck you, too, stick it up your ass, sit on it and spin, eat me raw through a flavor straw." He didn't respond, but did raise his head for a moment and locked eyes with Skip. Then he dropped his chin and hurried on past us. Sweat was running out of his crazed hair and down the sides of his face. Under his breath, he was muttering, "rip, rip, 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 rip," as if keeping time, or articulating what he'd like to do to the whole walking bunch of us, or maybe both. You could smell him, the sour, acrid tang of sweat. There was always that, because he wouldn't go slow. It seemed to offend him to go slow. But there was something else, too. The sweat was pungent, but not offensive. The undersmell was a lot less pleasant. I ran track in high school. Forced as a college freshman to choose between Paul Malls and the 440, I chose the coffin nails, and had smelled that particular combination before. Usually when some kid with the flu or the grip or a strep throat forced himself to run anyway. The only smell like it is an electric train transformer that's been run too hard for too long. Then he was past us. Stoke Jones, soon to be dubbed Rip Rip by Ronnie Malenfant, free of his huge leg braces for the evening and on his way back to the dorm. "Hey, what's that?" Nate asked. He had stopped and was looking back over his shoulder. Skip and I also stopped and looked back. I started to ask Nate what he meant, then saw. Jones was wearing a jeans jacket. On the back of it, drawn in what looked like black magic marker and just visible in the declining light of that early autumn evening, was a shape in a circle. "Dunno," Skip said. "It looks like a sparrow track." The boy on the crutches merged into the crowds on their way to another commons dinner on another Thursday night in another October. Most of the boys were clean-shaven. Most of the girls wore skirts and ship-and-shore blouses with Peter Pan collars. The moon was rising almost full, casting orange light on them. The full-blown age of freaks was still 2 years away, and none of the three of us realized we had seen the peace sign for the first time. Saturday morning breakfast was one of my meals to work the dish line in Holyoke. It was a good meal to have because the Commons was never busy on Saturday mornings. Carol Gerber, the silverware girl, stood at the head of the conveyor belt. I was next. My job was to grab the plates as the trays came down the belt, rinse them, and stack them on the trolley beside me. If traffic on the conveyor belt was busy, as it was at most weekday evening meals, I just stacked the plates up, shit and all, and rinsed them later on when things slowed down. Next in line to me was the glass boy or girl who grabbed the glasses and cups and popped them into special dishwasher grids. Holyoke wasn't a bad place to work. Every now and then some wit of the Ronnie Malenfant sensibility would return an uneaten kielbasa or breakfast sausage with a Trojan fitted over the end, or the oatmeal would come back with, "I go to fuck you," written in carefully torn up strips of napkin, once pasted on the surface of a soup bowl filled with congealing meatloaf gravy, was the message, "Help, I am being held prisoner in a cow college." And you wouldn't believe what pigs some kids can be. Plates filled with ketchup, milk glasses filled with mashed potatoes, splattered vegetables. But it really wasn't such a bad job, especially on Saturday mornings. I looked out once past Carol, who was looking extraordinarily pretty for so early in the morning, and saw Stoke Jones. His back was to the pass-through window, but you couldn't miss the crutches leaning next to his place, or that peculiar shape drawn on the back of his jacket. Skip had been right. It looked like a sparrow track. It was almost a year later when I first heard some guy on TV refer to it as the track of the great American chicken. "Do you know what that is?" I asked Carol, pointing. She looked for a long time, then shook her head. "Nope, must be some kind of in-joke." "Stoke doesn't joke." "Oh, my, you're a poet, you don't know it." "Quit it, Carol. You're killing me." When our shift was over, I walked her back to her dorm, telling myself I was just being nice, that walking Carol Gerber back to Franklin Hall in no way made me unfaithful to Anne-Marie Susie back in Gates Falls. Then ambled toward Chamberlain, wondering who might know what that sparrow track was. It occurs to me only at this late date that I never thought of asking Jones himself. And when I reached my floor, I saw something that changed the direction of my thoughts entirely. Since I'd gone out at 6:30 a.m. with one eye open to take my place behind Carol on the dish line, someone had shaving creamed David Dearborn's door, all around the sides, on the doorknob, and with an extra thick line along the bottom. In this lower deposit was a bare foot track that made me smile. Deary opens his door, clad only in a towel, on his way to the shower, and poosh, how are ya? Still smiling, I went into 302. Nate was writing at his desk. Observing the way he kept one arm curled protectively around his notebook, I deduced it was that day's letter to Cindy. Someone shaving creamed Deary's door, I said, crossing to my shelves and grabbing my geology book. My plan was to head down to the third-floor lounge and do a little studying for the quiz on Tuesday. Nate tried to look serious and disapproving, but couldn't help smiling himself. He was always trying for self-righteousness in those days and always falling just a little bit short. I suppose he's gotten better at it over the years, more's the pity. You should have heard him yell, Nate said. He snorted in laughter, then put one small fist up to his mouth to stifle any further impropriety. And swear, for a minute there he was in Skip's League. When it comes to swearing, I don't think anyone's in Skip's League. Nate was looking at me with a worried furrow between his eyes. You didn't do it, did you? Because I know you were up early. If I was going to decorate Deary's door, I would have used toilet paper, I said. All my shaving cream goes on my own face. I'm a low-budget student, just like you, remember? The worry furrow smoothed out, and Nate once more looked like a choir boy. For the first time, I realized he was sitting there in nothing but his jockey shorts and that stupid blue beanie. That's good, he said, because David was yelling that he'd get whoever did it and see that the guy was put on disciplinary pro. DP for creaming his fucking door? I doubt it, Nate. It's weird, but I think he meant it, Nate said. Sometimes David Dearborn reminds me of that movie about the crazy ship captain. Humphrey Bogart was in it. Do you know the one I mean? Yeah, the Kane Mutiny. Uh-huh. And David, well, let's just say that for him, handing out DP is what being floor proctor is all about. In the university's code of rules and behavior, expulsion was the big gun, reserved for offenses like theft, assault, and possession/use of drugs. Disciplinary probation was a step below that, punishment for such offenses as having a girl in your room, and having one in your room after women's curfew could tilt the penalty toward expulsion, hard as that is to believe now. Having alcohol in your room, cheating on exams, plagiarism. Any of these latter offenses could theoretically result in expulsion, and in cheating cases often did, especially if the cases involved midterm or final exams. But mostly it was disciplinary pro, which you carried with you for an entire semester. I didn't like to believe a dorm proctor would try to get a DP from Dean of Men Gerritsen for a few harmless bursts of shaving cream, but this was Deary, a prig who had so far insisted on